You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Today on Flashpoints, a frontline update on the massive refugee caravan now stalled at the Guatemalan-Mexican border. Meanwhile, Trump is threatening to call out the troops against them. Also, indigenous communities in the U.S. fighting for their right to vote in the face of a new decision by the Supreme Court to uphold the lower court ruling that forces the indigenous community to do things that, it's a setup. It's a purge, and we're going to take a very close look at it. Also, we're going to hear from some women who are marching on the Pentagon this weekend, calling for no more war. How much money is the Pentagon spending now? How much killing is going on in our name? So these women are there to bear witness, and we're going to hear a little bit about what's going on at the Pentagon. I'm Dennis Bernstein with my good brother, Miguel Gavilán Molina. This is our Friday Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, KPFA. Please stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I'm here in the studio with Miguel Gavilán Molina. And we're joined on the telephone by Alex Mensing, who has, been working with a number of different groups to give support, protection to the caravans of refugees fleeing violence and really U.S. foreign policy for so many years. And now you, I know, have heard about this massive caravan moving from Honduras, moved through Guatemala. It's now sort of poised, or shall we say there's a struggle going on at the border between Guatemala, Miguel, and Mexico. Alex Mensing, thanks for joining us. Could you give us a complete update as best as you can? We know that some of the members of the folks that you're working with have been arrested for their work in support of these refugees.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Dennis. So I think that it's important to to talk about the arrests, get the greater context. On literally 1 week ago, just 1 week ago, a group of less than 200 Hondurans were gathered at a bus station in San Pedro Sula in Honduras. And the number that has joined in this caravan of people fleeing, this mass exodus of people fleeing Honduras, has grown to the numbers vary from anywhere from 2,000 to 4,000 people who are there are about 2,000 people at the border, and then there's an unknown number of people still in Guatemala moving towards the border. And all along the way, the response of the Central American governments, the Mexican government, and the U.S. government has been repression. It has been state violence. It has been arbitrary detention. Not only towards the members of the caravan who were stopped by giant blockades of Guatemalan police and then Honduran police even trying to keep people from leaving their own country. There's also been the targeting of the not only journalists but organizers and activists who are supporting the caravan. First of all, with the journalist Bartolo Fuentes, who is a Honduran journalist and former member of their Congress, who was accompanying the caravan through Guatemala. He was arrested on Tuesday by the Guatemalans, and he was just today deported back to Honduras. And the local government, which he opposes in Honduras, and which is an unconstitutional, fraudulently elected government, has essentially been calling for his head. And then yesterday, Irineo Mujica, Irineo Mujica of our organization, Pueblo Sin Fronteras, was participating in a peaceful march on the Mexican side of the Guatemala-Mexico border where they were going to greet the Hondurans who were arriving at the border yesterday. He was picked out by a group of about 15 federal police officers and 20 immigration agents who essentially went straight for him, and they violently arrested him and took them away in an immigration van. And this is a Mexican citizen being taken away by immigration agents. We didn't know where he was for 4 hours until we were able to find out that there are charges being pressed against him, and he is in federal custody in a city in Chiapas in Mexico.
So he's being held now by the Mexican authorities.
Correct. He's being held by the Mexican authorities. He has an attorney. There's already been paperwork submitted to oppose the unconstitutionality of his illegal detention. He's been charged with a number of different things. It's clearly bogus and made up, not only because he didn't do the things that he's being accused of, but the story keeps changing. At first they said he was throwing things at officers, which he would never do. Then they said that he had slashed tires of a federal vehicle. The government is just looking for any excuse to lock him up, especially during these critical moments when today, literally, a group of 2,000 Hondurans were at the gates of Mexico being repressed by the Mexican police. They used tear gas against groups of women and children. People are throwing themselves off of the bridge in order to get across. The desperation here is enormous, and the response, the security oriented repressive response of every government in the entire region is completely unacceptable. It's completely inadequate. This is a humanitarian crisis, and it requires a humanitarian response.
So just to stay for a moment with that encounter, because I've heard some pretty scary things about what's been going on and sort of the way in which people were ultimately fleeing the violence in whatever direction. Do we know how many people were hurt? The people who were hurt, were they treated? Do we have any information more about that?
I haven't heard any numbers yet because this is happening in real time right now. I've seen many firsthand accounts that are being published of people who have been hurt by hurt in the river, who have been beaten by officers who have negative effects of the pepper spray that's being used against them. In the attack on our organizer during a march yesterday, there were at least 4 or 5 people who were injured, including one of the members of Pueblo Sin Fronteras whose rib was broken by the federal police. Where there's a heavy, heavy level of violence being used against people. And it's what's happening as well. It's happening on the Honduras-Guatemala border as well. Just a few hours ago, Honduran police beat a group of people who were trying to leave to join the caravan. This is Hondurans inside their own country being beaten by their own police to prevent them from fleeing, to prevent them from exiting the country.
Wow. Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavilán Molina. We're speaking with Alex Mensing of Pueblo Sin Fronteras, and we're talking about this caravan that could be anywhere from 2,000 to 4,000 folks fleeing Honduras or joining along the way. Now the confrontation has been taking place at the border between Guatemala and Mexico, and the Mexican security forces are sparing very little in going after these folks. I mean, it's frightening because these are people who are trying to flee violence and apply for asylum, and they're getting brutalized.
Absolutely. There is no distinction between people being made whatsoever. And I think there is an internationally recognized and a nationally recognized right to seek asylum and seek refuge, both in Mexico and the United States. But I think we're also seeing the failure of the asylum system to meet the needs of this crisis. There are people who, many, many people are being denied asylum in the United States, denied asylum in Mexico. So the system that is designed to legally receive and protect these people is not functioning. There's a level of corruption in the Mexican asylum office that is getting out of control. And in the United States, the U.S. government and the Department of Justice are cracking down on asylum here. And so I think what needs to be recognized, we need to take a step back from talking about the language of asylum and look at what's going on here. There's a massive number of people who can no longer live in their country because the country has been destroyed by policies of intervention, both military, economic, and political intervention, that don't allow people to have any sort of democracy or self-determination. The current government of Honduras is completely illegitimate. The elections were fraudulent, and they were unconstitutional to begin with. The government of Jimmy Morales is not doing anything representative of his people. The government of Guatemala is trying to prevent the prosecutor who is in charge of prosecuting corruption from coming into the country. And both of these governments are essentially doing what the United States is telling them, which is based on a racist anti-immigrant agenda.
Alex, this is Miguel Gavilan. It's interesting what you just said, because behind the scenes, you know, we see the Washington administration putting tremendous pressure on Mexico, you know, and the Mexican government. And of course, they in turn, you know, put pressure on Guatemala, put pressure on Honduras. Is there any international effort from the United Nations to send observers to start looking at this? Because as you said, this is a humanitarian crisis, you know, and you're absolutely correct when you say people have a right to migration. People have a right to flee death and destruction. And this is what's happening here. And as you mentioned, this is all due to United States foreign policy in Central America, in the region for the last 30, 40 years. How can people help? People are, you know, I've been asked, well, what can we do? Is there anything that I can do? And my question to you, Alex, is, are you, is Pueblos Sin Fronteras, are you working with Border Watch? Are you working with any kind of international body like the United Nations or a group from the UN to look at this crisis and bring more attention and focus? Because the media here in this country is all focused on the soap opera in Washington, D.C. And according to the president, as of last night, at one of his rallies, he made it sound like the caravan was already at the U.S.-Mexican border, the way he was fanning it and presenting it. What can people do, and is there efforts to reach out to the international community?
I think that that's a question that's going to have to be answered over the next few days as we see what organizations step forward in southern Mexico. Right now, people are very unclear. This happened very quickly. Members of Pueblos Sin Fronteras were able to respond only in the last few days to what's happening. And there's going to be a very heavy need for basic humanitarian assistance in southern Mexico. There's an organization in Tapachula, a human rights center called the Fray Matias Human Rights Center, that I'm hoping will have some capacity to channel support. Pueblos Sin Fronteras, at this point on the ground, only has the capacity to essentially observe what's going on and try to help coordinate the efforts of the people who are there, who have been fleeing themselves. There's going to be a very large need for legal assistance, especially Mexican attorneys who can go to southern Mexico and help figure out what sort of a solution can be made. And the U.S., supposedly the United Nations, has been called on to set up some sort of humanitarian attention or refugee processing in southern Mexico right now. I don't know what their response has been to that. I know that they have expressed, the UN, United Nations has expressed concern for the people who are fleeing, but in terms of concrete action to be taken to support them, I haven't seen anything yet. And it's going to take the next few days to see who has the capacity to coordinate some of this. But I would say that boots on the ground for people with skills like attorneys or doctors are crucial. And over the next couple of days, I'm hoping that some organizations arise who are going to have the capacity to channel food and water and shelter, because that's going to be a really big need very, very soon here.
All right. Alex Mensing, working with Pueblos Sin Fronteras, doing extraordinary work. And we didn't even talk about the fact that there are still hundreds of children. And now Trump is threatening, you know, based on this caravan, he wants to bring back his break up the family policy. More threats on that. It's a terrible situation. Alex Mensing, again, we thank you for the incredibly important work that you do with that group. And we hope that you can continue to keep us posted. And if people want more information, yep, how do they get it? If they want to get in touch with you all, support what you do.
Yes, there's our Facebook page, which is Pueblo Sin Fronteras, facebook.com/Pueblo, P-U-E-B-L-O-S-F. That's also our Twitter handle, and we're at pueblosinfronteras.org. So please check us out.
All right. Thank you very much for the incredibly important work.
Be careful.
Thanks, Dennis and Miguel.
Yeah,
thank
be
you.
Careful. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short musical break, and then we're going to be joined by some folks representing the Lakota People's Law Project and the battle, amazing, the battle in North Dakota and across the country of indigenous people in this country that was stolen from them to have the right to vote. So we're looking forward to a very powerful segment. We'll take a short break. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavilán Molina. Free Will and Frank is at the board. This is Friday Flashpoints. We'll be back. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I'm in the studio with Miguel Gavilán Molina. And we want to welcome two significant legal minds, people who are on the front lines of fighting for indigenous rights. And we're talking about Phyllis Young. Phyllis Young, well, I'm going to let her tell you a bit about her background. But she certainly was on the front lines at Standing Rock and has been a sort of a legal cutting-edge warrior trying to restrain the destruction of the flow of water through indigenous communities. Now the battle is to keep the vote. So Phyllis Young, welcome.
Thank you.
And also welcome to Danny Sheehan, old friend of the show, of mine, a brilliant legal mind. Danny, we have been in this a very long time from Christic Institute. Now you're working, and we know that we were sort of overlapping at Standing Rock, where you now continue to defend Chase Iron Eyes, one of the organizers who's facing severe charges. We've seen one more move to undermine the indigenous community's rights to vote with this sustaining by the Supreme Court of the lower court decision requiring, licenses with certain kind of address in order to be able to vote. And we know it's really just sort of another electronic attempt at Jim Crow voting fraud or, disenfranchisement by folks who do not want these communities to vote. You want to, I'd love to, for both of you, maybe you could start, Denny, and then Phyllis, respond to the decision of the courts and what is the significance of this sustaining of the Supreme Court of this lower court decision?
Well, technically, what's happened here is that originally, Judge Hovland, who is the federal district court judge in Bismarck, he ruled that it was unconstitutional and illegal for the state of North Dakota to have cut off the a significant majority of the Native American people from being able to vote this November 6th because they entered a new rule saying that in order for you to vote, you have to have a street address on your identification. And a significant number of people who live on the reservations in North Dakota have no technical street address. They live in rural communities. They have post office addresses. They have Native American ID. They have tribal ID that has their post office box number and everything on it. But after the close election back 6 years ago, where the extreme conservative lost to the moderate conservative, Heidi Heitkamp, they decided they were going to try to exclude the Native people because the 3,000 votes by which the moderate won the contest last time was largely dependent upon Native American voters. And Phyllis's family, her daughter, and others were directly involved in helping to get the Native people to come forward and vote. And the right wing in North Dakota that's under the kind of whip hand of the oil companies now as a result of this major confrontation with the oil pipeline, they thought that they had to suppress the Native American vote. So they came up with this new rule, basically excluding the vast majority of Native American people. So Judge Hovland struck that down, saying it was clear that this was designed to prevent Native American people from voting. And Judge Hovland is no liberal, that's for sure. He's a very, very conservative guy. But he even recognized that this was completely illegal. It went up to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed him and said, no, that they're going to be allowed to do this. This is a legitimate thing to have done. And so when an appeal was taken or sought to the United States Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court now, with Kavanaugh and the other hardcore 5-4 reactionary majority there, declined to review it. And so therefore, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals decision stands, authorizing them to exclude the Native American people. So what's happened now is, there's a major mobilization that's underway. Phyllis will tell you more about it. Phyllis has been designated by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Council to come forward to try to help mobilize and organize Native American people to come forward and to secure the kind of identification that's necessary to comply with this new regulation, since they've exhausted all of their legal means of trying to set aside this restriction.
All right, let me jump in here, actually. That's a good moment for a segue. Phyllis Young, I'd like you to talk about what the struggle looks like now, but if you could take a few minutes to talk about the hardship and the way in which this decision by the courts makes it it's sort of ridiculous and impossible for Indian communities to vote. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I look at the IDs that they require. Back in 2014, I was not allowed to vote using my U.S. passport, and I was shocked and amazed. But so this has been going on since we made a difference in voting for the last the senator in the last election. And so one of the acceptable licenses, a driver's license, and we have no service for driver's license here, and the closest is about 75 miles to get a driver's license. We don't have the testing or the training operation here that is available in the state of North Dakota. So to get to meet that requirement, we have to travel to Bismarck, or the nearest one is like 60 miles in Flasher or Carson to get when they have designated days to do your driver's license testing with a car. So we don't have that. We have to go 60 miles at least to the west, or straight north 75 miles to meet that requirement for a driver's license and a state ID. So we're not privy to having the operations right here that we can get it in a day. So what we're doing is trying to meet the requirements of those. We don't have street numbers, and so the tribal council has opened the enrollment office for free IDs up until November 6th, where they will have an opportunity to put the numbers on their and their streets on their IDs. So we're having to go to the University of Arizona and get the top notch high tech plats and geophysical operations for the land to validate the streets for they are the experts in the country, so we're utilizing them. On Monday, we will begin. The tribe has given out forms to renew their IDs or to get new ones, and so we'll be mobilizing to get them to get their new IDs. We were advised to go to the 911, who are the sheriff of the county, and on Tuesday, all of the 911 operators had a power outage in North Dakota. So ploy or tactic or whatever it may be, we could not access the 911 number to the sheriff. And some of the elders who are in proximity to businesses are given, one elder was given the address of a bar across the street, a liquor store. So he came to the council and said, I'm a teetotaler, and if they're trying to put that old, what do you call that? You put that identity on an Indian, a drunken Indian, that's not me. Because I do not drink, and my address is not the local bar. So we are not using the 911 system, which is a county and state system. So we are embarking upon validation of the tribal system and creating the streets and numbers for ourselves. We may use the community buildings for the address for that we do traditionally and collectively for our people who reside in the community, we know by name. So my job is to validate with a form that I do indeed know this person, that this is indeed their address, and that we sign as a witness to submit with their vote. So we also challenged the polling. We were advised there would only be one polling place to vote in Sioux County. And so we questioned that, and we got the state, the Secretary of State, to send us a communique saying that we had five polling places. Would be open from noon till 4. And so one of the requests that the tribe made to the secretary was that we be entitled to the 7 a.m. to the 7 p.m. time factor for operations for keeping the voting polls open for that length of time. We demanded the full number of hours that we could have the polls.
Well, it would seem to me that would certainly makes sense. And that's the voice of Phyllis Young. We're talking about the struggle for Native Americans, indigenous communities in North Dakota now, based on a recent ruling, to be able to have the right to vote. You know, Danny, this Supreme Court decision comes after years of a lot of organizing. First, the Indian communities sort of said, we're not even going to bother with white people. Then, 10, 15 years ago, a lot of organizing went on. This seems to be a direct result, an attempt to repress a very successful sort of 5-7 year organizing campaign to vote.
Well, what it is, Dennis, is, for example, in the latest confrontation that went on between the Native people, the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation people, and the Native people from all around North Dakota and the Dakotas to challenge the Dakota Access Pipeline, one of the major defenses that we ended up establishing was this necessity defense, saying that, look, all of the efforts to try to get to vote, to try to get access to the courts, to try to exercise the kind of normal rights that American people have to affect the policies of their government were being foreclosed to the Native people. And that was why the type of demonstration that they engaged in was necessary, because they had to assert their necessity defense to go onto the land to try to stop the pipeline, because the courts were closed to them, the voting access was closed to them. And here it comes now, the state of North Dakota, that had made the arguments in their briefs opposing the necessity defense, saying, oh, well, if you don't like what the policies are, you should just vote. And they actually said that in their legal briefs. And here you turn around and the people try to vote and they get shut down. So it's absolutely clear, just like you see in Georgia, just like you see in Texas, just like you see over and over again in a number of the states, that the 12 states that were previously under government restrictions about not being able to set forth these kind of constraints on voting, that now that the United States Supreme Court has removed those from these states, they're going right back to it. And this is what this is. This is an attempt to close the Native people off from making the election. There are 29,000 people, Native people, that are eligible to vote in the state of North Dakota. There's only 583,000 people that are eligible to vote in the state. 5% of them are Native American people, 29,000 people. And the last senatorial race was decided by only 3,000 votes. And so the extreme reactionaries there, who are the allies of the oil corporations, et cetera, are fearful that the Native people are going to come out in response to what happened with the oil corporations and vote to try to get changes in the policy. And so this action is being taken to close them off, to stop them from having access to the voting polls, that prohibiting them from voting if they don't have a street address, prohibiting them from having the same 12-hour period in which to vote, trying to restrict their voting period from noontime to 4 o'clock. These steps are being taken persistently by the Republican-dominated judicial and legal system in that state to try to close off the Native American people. And the people around the country see this. They're mobilizing, and they're talking about it on television. The MSNBC news every evening talks about it. The CNN is talking about it. Now KPFA is talking about it. You know, I just had an interview this morning at New York City with Gary Knoll and the people there. They're all talking about it. So the world is looking once again. The world turned its attention to the state of North Dakota during the Standing Rock opposition to the pipeline, and now they're turning their attention to this again. And the Native people, the people like Phyllis and the tribal council leadership there, are mobilizing to do everything that we can do to get the Native people to comply with these regulations, because now that Kavanaugh is on the Supreme Court, this is their first demonstration of shutting off the people at the very top. Even if you can get a conservative court to rule in favor of you at the trial court level, when it gets all the way to the Court of Appeals level and to the Supreme Court level, they reverse it and they cut you off. There's 263 new federal judges are being appointed by Donald Trump, coming directly off the list in the Federalist Society. And this is what they're doing. This is the same thing that happened in Germany in the 1930s. The big corporations put their lawyers on the courts, and they began to shut out the people. That's what happened back during the robber baron era after the Civil War from 1868 to 1898. The major corporations, the oligopolies and the monopoly corporations, put their lawyers onto the courts, and they began to shut the people out. This is what's happening here. So this rising up of the Lakota people to try to comply with these strenuous rules that are being put down upon them is a further demonstration of the willingness on the part of Native people to try to cooperate, to try to do what is proper, to try to stay within the law. It's being demonstrated over and over again that the white lawyers in charge of the government are trying to outsmart them all the time and shut them out. That's what's happening in North Dakota. But the people are rising up, and they're going to mobilize and organize. And a lot of the same allies that were working together to try to stop the pipeline coming in are now moving in to try to help on this voter movement. So Phyllis is at the very point of the spear on this. They have offices set up there at the Standing Rock Reservation inside the tribal headquarters to mobilize and to work. They're going to have volunteers coming in to help them, and they're going to spread out across the state to try to get all of the people to comply with these new regulations and get them to the polls. That's so everybody's standing by to assist in this successful operation right now.
Well, let me ask you, Daniel, this is Miguel Gavilan. The situation as we find it now, we have less than, 17 days before November the 6th? I mean, time's really running out here. And North Dakota is a vast area. You know, the communities, you know, from one town to a city and so forth. It's going to take a tremendous effort. But one of the biggest concerns, and we saw this arise during the Kavanaugh hearings, and that was his record on Native American issues that go back, you know, 20, 30 years, wasn't at all favorable, you know, for Native communities. And now we have him as a Supreme Court justice. The court has shifted. It's gotten more conservative. There's suppression everywhere throughout the South. But Native communities are taking, you know, the battle to the forefront. What can communities in general do? Because there's a lot of voter suppression happening, not just on reservations, but in poor working class communities, and particularly communities of color. We see a lot of that in the South, the southern part of this country. What can be done to push back on this? Again, we're running out of time, and if folks aren't successful, it looks like people might galvanize for the next 2 years, because the battle isn't going to end November the 6th. It goes on for another couple of years. What do you see, Daniel, as a future, and how can people rally behind Native communities, you know, to protect the vote? Because it looks like, you know, the powers of corporate state, the industrialists, they want to suppress the vote so votes don't matter anymore.
Sure they do. And you're exactly right. But this next 17 days of mobilizing and organizing in the state of North Dakota is just a microcosm of what has to be done. We have a two-year period that's going to be going on from November 7th of 2018 all the way to 2020, November 6th. And the people have to mobilize. They have to get to the polls and vote. They have to overwhelm these polling places and go in there and insist upon voting. The people are bringing their identification. The tribal councils are mobilizing to try to issue more identification with street addresses, et cetera, to try to develop them, even to the extent of going to the University of Arizona and getting them to kind of geographically designate how you can set up street addresses on the reservations. Everybody's trying to comply with this, but the bottom line is that people need to get to the polls and vote. They've got to move these people out of power. They have to put into power more progressive people who are going to be supportive of this. The Democratic Party, for example, there are 60 congressional districts in the United States that you're going to have to focus on after these elections here coming up in 2 weeks or so. There are 60 congressional districts where the Democratic Party wins those elections by 20 points to 40 points every 2 years, and they still have representatives in there, 10-term, 12-term, 8-term Congress people who vote 60% of the time the wrong way. They vote for the most conservative and reactionary programs, even though they could nominate a ham sandwich and get them elected in the Democratic Party, and they just aren't doing it. So
all
the
right.
People have to mobilize and run for office, vote for the people who are running for office, and challenge every single effort to suppress the vote of the minority people, because this is an effort on the part of white male corporate executives to take control of this country, just like they did in Germany in the 1930s. And we have to move to stop this now.
Phyllis Young, now you're on the cutting edge here. As Miguel mentioned, there's only a few days between now and the election. What are the sort of the frontline things? Again, remind us that you're going to try to do, and perhaps people can be pay attention and learn more about it and tune into a website or a place where they can follow or support the work that you're doing.
We ran out of ballots in the last two elections, and we cannot afford that. And we are not allowed early voting. Only the larger counties are provided that. So we're not waiting. We have a line of people who will do absentee starting Monday morning with the new. We'll have a team who will help them with their forms for new IDs. We will take them directly to the county voting polls in three communities, and we will push and prod the auditors to take the absentee ballots on site without having to take them out and mail them back and all that. We're not going to wait. We're going to begin the early vote for ourselves by absentee ballots. We're having a concert for the target group are the young people. It's not the elderly. We've done it. So we're having a concert. We're having a psychedelic bus with music going through the communities. It's all for the young people. We're going to generate the campaign to vote, and we're getting the vote out by the young people. So we have an aggressive campaign that we're doing under Article 6 of the 1868 Treaty. We are citizens of the United States, and we're guaranteed the freedoms and the immunities of all the laws that apply to citizenship. So we're taking advantage of that. That's statutory, 15 Statute 635. Ratified by the Congress in February of 1869. So we're going to utilize our rights to the maximum as American citizens, and we're going to the early vote. We're lining them up on Monday. We're not going to wait till Election Day or until we run out of ballots. We're going to make our young people on the move and exercise their vote.
All right. Well, we really, Miguel and I want to thank both of you. Daniel Sheehan, many years of good work goes all the way back. The work holding the Reagan administration accountable for the Contras. Karen Silkwood, I mean, the history that you've made based on your legal work, Danny, is just simply amazing. And, of course, it's beautiful to hear from Phyllis Young and to know that there's some serious activity happening in resistance of this ongoing drumbeat attempt across the South and the West to undermine the vote of people of color, of indigenous communities in very active ways. The suppression campaign by the right wing in this country is out of control. We would love to come back to the both of you, but we thank you today for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis. We appreciate it. Thank you, Phyllis.
So welcome. You're both so welcome. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavilan Molina. And we're going to welcome back an old friend to the show who is in Washington, D.C., because there's a women's march on the Pentagon. And it's a very important thing to do. We're going to hear all about it. Stay with us. That was a
they want me to shoot. They want me to kill. They say that that's real. People's devastation is a creation of these demonstrations. United Nations is a waste that they making complaints, complications. Just listen to us. We're the originals, we're the originals. The people's of tribes like the name and the Hopi. We were fine before you, we didn't have doping. How could you really?
Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavilán Molina. This is Friday Flashpoints. And I want to welcome back an old friend to this show and somebody who's been doing incredibly good work and came into this with a profoundly sad occurrence of having her son, losing her son to an unnecessary war. I'm talking about Cindy Sheehan. She's in Washington, D.C., and there's the Women's March on the Pentagon. Cindy Sheehan, welcome back to Flashpoints. Nice to have you back on the air again.
Hi, Dennis. It's been a long, long time.
A long time. But this Women's March on the Pentagon, you know, I'm trying to remember the year. But many years ago, do you know when the first one was?
The Women's March on the Pentagon was in 1980, I believe.
I was helping to take care of an extraordinary old woman, she would say, a peace activist named Anne McVeigh Upshur. And she went with a young activist named Caleb Litt at the time. She went. They drove from New York City some 7 hours to surround the Pentagon. I'll never forget this. And to, like, chant and join hands. And, you know, I thought, oh, this is a powerful symbolic action. But it's more than symbolic, isn't it?
What our action is this weekend?
Yes.
Or the action in 1980? Well, we're hoping that it's going to be more than symbolic. I think for many, many years, well, for the last 10 years, there really hasn't been much of an anti-war movement because, of course, the six wars that Obama got the U.S. into, well, his regime got the U.S. into and never ended the wars that Bush regime got the U.S. into. There was very little anti-war movement, although some of us are anti-imperialists, and we keep on trying to, you know, invigorate some kind of movement against the U.S. empire. And so this weekend, I think the sense I'm getting, it's going to be the best, highest energy, largest anti-war movement we've had in Washington, D.C. since before Obama was elected. It just has a lot of high energy. And we hope we're going to go forward with a coalition of nonpartisan anti-war peace activists, anti-imperialist activists, whatever you want to call it, that's intent on having a true people-led, female-led movement against imperialism, not just Republicans. And this is not a get-out-the-vote event for the Democrat Party at all, because we know that Democrats can be even worse than Republicans when it comes to the war machine and imperialism. So we're saying that this is the kickoff event on Sunday. We hope for a bright new movement that will actually be dedicated, long lived, and hopefully short-lived in the fact that maybe one of these days the empire will collapse under its own weight, but we'll be there to have the safety nets because we've been organizing for so long.
You will surround. What will happen? What is planned?
We're marching on the Pentagon. We're call it a march on the Pentagon. So we're going to have a short march from the Pentagon City metro station to the Pentagon. And we're having a 3-hour rally there with musical guests, speakers, and really to get people signed up and energized to not stop, to say it doesn't matter who gets elected in November. It doesn't matter if it's a Democrat Congress or a Republican Congress. When it comes to the issue of war and peace, the wars keep going. And in fact, they could, you know, they have expanded. Trump has dropped more bombs than Obama did. Obama dropped more bombs than Bush did and expanded the war machine greatly. So we realize that politics is a big part of what we do, and political energy and political activism, but to be outside the two-party duopoly, the war party, we call it, and to organize that way, not to say every... This isn't a reactive, this protest isn't reactionary. We've been planning it since February. We're not saying, oh, we hate something Trump does, so we're going to get a bunch of money from liberal donors and we're going to have a protest in a week. We've been working really hard since February to get a really great coalition of people who are nonpartisan like we are. We call ourselves a nonpartisan march on the bipartisan war machine. So it's not reactionary. We just didn't pop up overnight, and we're not going to dissipate and tell everybody to register to vote and vote for Democrats, because we know that that's not going to solve the problems.
This is Miguel Gavilan. I wanted to ask you, Cindy, the situation as we see it, it seems like this current administration is more like a puppet master. You know, it's been supporting, the Saudi prince. It's been supporting the Saudi Arabians with, you know, giving them more, jets, more airplanes, more bombs. And there's, it seems like the U.S. now's role is being an arms merchant, you know, addicted to weapons. We are in a war economy, and everything is good as long as the economy is, you know, moving ahead, which means as long as we're selling weapons, we're making more bombs, more jet fighters, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the role that I see this country taking now. Do you, as being the number ones, you know, arms producer and arms seller in the world, do you see a correlation with your action against that kind of approach by this current administration?
Are you saying that the Trump administration just started selling arms to Saudi Arabia?
Obama sold
the same amount of arms to Saudi Arabia as Trump is selling to Saudi Arabia. The United States has been supporting Saudi Arabia's horrible.
I thought it was more, actually.
Yemen.
I thought Obama sold them more anyway.
Yeah, and so that's what we're saying, that it doesn't matter who's president. The people have to recognize that the president is just a puppet of the war machine.
Yes.
Not that he's pulling the strings. But you know what is the good thing about Trump? If there's any positive thing about Trump, he's making it obvious.
Well, that's true, too. I wanted to ask you, when we think about the military, we often think just in terms of the horrific wars and the slaughters that the equipment that the United States supplies around the world and Israel supplies around the world. But the military, I believe it's the U.S. military that is the number one polluter in the world. Is that correct?
Right. Yes, and the number one user of fossil fuels in the world. So I just want to encourage everybody to go to the marchonpentagon.com website, because we do have the war and the environment, war and women, war and the economy. We have these articles. We've done the research and written these papers about these things. And so the Pentagon, everywhere the Pentagon goes or the war machine goes, the U.S. military becomes a Superfund site. And
I mean, has anybody ever done a test? I'm wondering, has anybody ever done a test of the ozone layer over Iraq and Iran?
Yeah, no, I don't know, but that would be interesting.
I'm sure you could learn a lot about war.
Agree. Oh. And also the poison of the depleted uranium. Look at the people in Vietnam are still having horrific birth defects from Agent Orange and dioxin. So, it's not It's this cancer that has its tentacles everywhere in the world. Every congressional district in this country has employs people. It puts people to work. It's a terrible economy that's dependent on making weapons of mass destruction, using them, making more, and employing people. So these Congress people depend on the military-industrial complex for their jobs, because the people in their districts depend on it for their jobs.
You know, I'm thinking about, one of the key testing grounds for all these new weapons is against the Palestinians. For instance, the Israelis shot over 100 Palestinians with their, today across the Gaza Strip, the target practice, I guess, testing the latest weaponry and the kind of bullets that shred bodies and make it impossible to put them together. So, you know, it's sort of part of the, I mean, that's where this has ended up. And this is today, and I'm sure you could trace all those bullets back to the, many of the bullets that shredded bodies today and yesterday back to various weapons deals and weapons dealers in the U.S. I mean, so
yeah,
I guess
that's what you're
going. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we're having this women's march on the Pentagon because the women's march, so anti-Trump women's march, the liberal one, refused to address war as a women's issue. We're an internationalist movement in solidarity with all the women and their families and communities around the world that are being oppressed, occupied by the U.S. or by its proxies like Israel and Saudi Arabia. It's a terrible thing to be so chauvinistic that you think your life is going to improve if Trump leaves, when these people in Gaza, in Yemen, are literally starving to death and being eliminated by other countries with the help of the United States. And we as citizens of this country, we have to be the ones to say that, that we're in solidarity with these people, and it has to stop.
All right. Well, we thank you for that. By the way, it reminds me on Monday, we're going to have an expanded report from Gaza. Sandy Tolley just back with some really troubling information about the latest statistics there and the kind of suffering that's going on. We do thank you, Cindy Sheehan, for all your years of resistance to war and your work now here with the Women's Pentagon March. For a website, again, one last reminder.
It's called MarchOnPentagon.com.
MarchOnPentagon.com. Thank you for joining us on Flashpoints.
Well, thank you. It was nice to talk to you again. Bye-bye.
Keep up the good work. And you are listening to Flashpoints. Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel. We have 30 seconds. But this was an amazing show, Miguel, and this is the work that we're going to keep up. We're going to be doing a lot of coverage of in terms of voter disenfranchisement. And, of course, we will stay right on top of that
humanitarian
march and those battles going on at the border there between Guatemala and Mexico.
And I hope people vote like their lives depend upon it.
They do.
Yes,
they
do.
Dennis Bernstein, Miguel Gavilán Molina. Thank you, Free Will and Frank at the board. We're out.
And that does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilán Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. And special thanks to Free Will and Frank Sterling for production. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Scott Noble's fine film, Human Resources. Today's focus is on control of the workplace and control of workers. I hope your boss allows you to stay tuned. John McPhee is a fine American writer of nonfiction prose. Much of his work was written in the late 20th century. I like his stuff a lot. Next time you're at your local bookstore or public library, feel free to grab a book or two of his essays. John McPhee, McPhee. Anyway, I've been rereading a book of his called The Pine Barrens. That's a foresty region in the state of New Jersey. In the 18th and early 19th centuries, wood from the Pine Barrens was made into charcoal, and that charcoal was used to fire industrial blast furnaces nearby. Many of these furnaces produced iron. Towns grew up around the furnaces, and here the workers lived. McPhee quotes from a factory journal kept by a clerk at one iron furnace. From this, we can get some inkling of the dynamics of the workplace. The workday was long, 12 hours. When the furnace was blasting, in the warm seasons, people worked 7 days a week. And I suspect the pay was low. But the journal shows something really interesting. By today's standards, the skilled factory workers were remarkably independent and powerful and cantankerous. Management's control over the workers seems much less than it is today. For example, on election day, most of the workers would probably take the day off and get drunk on the free booze provided at the polling place. At the start of deer hunting season, good luck in getting enough workers to show up to make any iron. Apparently, management cajoled and negotiated with their skilled workers. Didn't just command them, let alone intimidate them, as usually happens today. One class of iron workers, called molders, seems to have been particularly independent. Here are some entries from the clerk's journal. July 28, 1809. Molders all decided to quit work and went to the beach. July 30th. Molders returned from the beach. J. Ventling drunk and eating eggs at the slitting mill. Josh Townsend wanting to fight J. Williamson. Furnace boiled and the metal consolidated in the gutter. July 27, 1811. William Rose and his father both drunk and lying in the crossway. October 13, 1812. Election held at Bodine's Tavern. Hands chiefly there, some very drunk. October 30, 1812. Molders out hunting. J. Townsend killed a deer. You don't see that sort of independence and gumption among factory workers today. How come? That's because Workers don't have the power or control over the workplace today that they did 200 years ago. That's because, in the past two centuries, the factory owners worked long and hard to destroy the workers' power in the workplace, to shift the power ever upwards towards the top. Can you imagine the staff at a McDonald's restaurant taking 3 days off to go to the beach? I can't either. Stripping workers, and people generally, of power and control over their lives, in order to increase the wealth and power of the capitalist class. This is the broad theme of a wide-ranging documentary film called Human Resources. The film was made by Scott Noble in, I think, 2010. In this installment of New World Notes, and the next couple installments, we will hear a radio adaptation of this important film. My friend and colleague Robin Upton made this adaptation for his own radio program, Unwelcome Guests. UnwelcomeGuests.net. I'm going to skip over the first 20 minutes of the film, which focus on the eugenics movement. We'll pick up at the next major topic, how to degrade, dominate, and exploit your workers for fun and profit, and leave the workers too exhausted and depressed to fight back. Here is the film, Human Resources.
The desire for better order was epitomized by the Hawthorne experiments, which created a new model for organizing and supervising industrial workers. They are widely credited with putting the human factor back into industrial relations. Yet, as with previous experiments in the workplace, the ultimate effect would be to increase the power of the great capitalists at the expense of everyone else.
Only we're not automatons. We have eyes to see with, ears to hear with, and mouths to talk. Shop steward at GE Bridgeport. Forces of production.
The story of what is now termed scientific management, or Taylorism, begins decades earlier, when Frederick Winslow Taylor was hired by Bethlehem Steel to increase efficiency in the industrial workplace. Once upon a time, the greatest theorist of the free market, Adam Smith, had warned that division of labor would create a catastrophe for human society. Frederick Taylor disagreed. In Taylor's view, there was far too little division of labor. Factories could be run far more efficiently if tasks were mechanized and broken down even further. In a series of experiments, he set out to reduce every task performed in a factory into individual units, measuring how long they took and setting targets for workers to meet. On its surface, scientific management seems like an excellent idea. Increased efficiency allows more products to be manufactured in a shorter amount of time. Yet there was another, more sinister motivation lurking in the background. Ever since the 19th century, machine shops had been the bastion of skilled labor. What this meant was that a considerable degree of power remained concentrated on the shop floor. The same skills that made production possible also enabled machinists to challenge management when they felt they were being treated unfairly. For management, this was an unacceptable bargaining chip. For Taylor, it was simply inefficient.
You find that the man does not change very much. Whatever else changes. They boast in the aeroplane world, it will take some other countries a generation to catch up with our quality. And it is not because their engineers are inferior, but because our ordinary workmen have a tradition of skill behind them.
George Ritzer, author of The McDonaldization of Society.
Taylorism was certainly about de-skilling. It was about studying what skilled workers did to decompose those tasks into their basic elements and then teaching people to do specific aspects of it without learning the entire set of or array of activities that were involved and are involved for a skilled person. In that sense, it's a mechanism of control because you dictate to people, well, you do this part of the entire task and you don't do anything else, and you dictate to 8, 10, or 12 people various specific aspects of the whole task rather than allowing a skilled person to decide how the entire task should be done. So there's very much control involved there. To the degree that this involves de-skilling and involves control, it tends to take power away from workers. It takes power away from, therefore, the collectivity of workers, and therefore makes them less likely to be rebellious, makes them less likely to form various kinds of movements that would operate against, let's say, broadly, the capitalist system. So this is something that management thinks is a good idea for the workers, but is not a good idea for them. They have to be free to be creative. And in fact, Henry Ford, in his biography, said exactly that. Basically, he said something like, I'm too smart to have these kind of rational principles imposed on me. But those stupid workers out there, we need to impose those principles on them because they wouldn't know what to do if we didn't impose those principles on them. So rationalization, McDonaldization, is always something that those on top want to impose on the bottom, but something they don't want to affect their work at all. Henry Ford, in effect, invented the automobile assembly line and more generally the system that came to be known as Fordism. One aspect of Fordism had to do with hierarchical control over workers, and more specifically, the control over workers by the assembly line. So all a worker might do, for example, is put a hubcap on a car as that car went past as it was being constructed on the assembly line. So instead of a thinking, creative, skilled worker, you had a kind of mindless kind of worker who repetitively did the same task over and over again. Well, that kind of worker is robot-like. You are forced into a series of robot-like actions. The most interesting thing for me about McDonaldization or Weber's broader concept of rationalization is the idea of the irrationality of rationality, that these rational systems inevitably spawn all sorts of irrational consequences. This is supposed to be an efficient system, yet it ends up being very often inefficient. It's dehumanizing, one of the kind of ultimate irrationalities from my point of view.
In their study, Where Have All the Robots Gone?, Harold Shepard and Neil Herrick confirmed what many had long suspected. People trapped in an unrewarding work life were not only more likely to be dissatisfied, but were also more likely to suffer from low self-esteem, a feeling of helplessness, alienation, and to be plagued by a variety of mental disorders. The workers, who were the most dissatisfied and whose mental health was the most impaired, were the least likely to vote or participate in community organizations.
Michael Albert, co-creator of Paracon.
If you work in an environment where you're beaten up all the time, well, you're beaten up. Moreover, if you work in an environment that is so fragmented, that so robs you of dignity and so robs you of the expression of your own capacities, then they'll be diminished. You'll be deadened. You'll be bored. You will be reduced in your potentials, and you are not too likely to take initiative in other domains either. This is why Taylorism is pursued. This is why fragmenting of work is pursued. It weakens the workers, not just on the job, but in their communities too, which is what you want to do so that they don't take more of the income from themselves, thus reducing profits for the elites. So it's a perfectly sensible policy, a perfectly sensible approach, a devil's approach, but a perfectly sensible approach from the point of view of those at the top who are trying to stay there and who are trying to advance. Moreover, if they don't, they just get wiped out. So it's not even really an option. What you'd have to do is to create a new kind of economy in which these situations and these conditions don't restrict our options. The corporate entity, corporate person, it's not really a person, but call it an entity, is it pathological? Answer yes. Why? Because it drives toward profit regardless of the broader implications. It doesn't matter if your drive toward profit induces pain and suffering, promotes, you know, generates black lung disease in a mine, or pollutes the environment, or literally destroys the society. It doesn't matter. You're forced by the nature of the social relations inside and among corporations, the market system, to pursue, to accumulate, to pursue profits.
If hierarchy is the defining characteristic of scientific management, it should not be surprising that it was met with great praise, not only by the capitalist world, but by fascists and authoritarian communists. Mussolini set up a propaganda arm of his government to promote Taylorism, while Lenin wrote in Pravda in 1918 that we must introduce in Russia the study and the teaching of the Taylor system and its systematic trial and adaptation. As in America, workers in Russia were unimpressed with scientific management. A major contributing factor to the Kronstadt Rebellion of 1921 was the introduction of Taylor's techniques. Immediately after the rebellion was crushed, a government document on rationalization spoke of the instinctive mistrust of all workers toward all kinds of experiments directed at extracting greater productivity from them. Workers at Kronstadt had envisioned a decentralized system where they would actually own and control their own work and resources, but Lenin had something different in mind. Socialism, Lenin wrote, is merely state capitalist monopoly, which is made to serve the interests of the whole people and has to that extent ceased to be capitalist monopoly. The new means of control have been created not by us, but by capitalism in its military imperialist stage.
Noam Chomsky.
The Leninist system was one of the greatest blows that socialism suffered in the 20th century, maybe second only to fascism. I mean, as Lenin took power, among its first acts, along with Trotsky, were to destroy the socialist institutions that had arisen in the pre-Bolshevik period. Soviets, factory councils, constituent assembly, which was dominated by left social revolutionaries, largely peasant-based. And, of course, they went to war against the anarchists, a major war to try to wipe them out, the Makhno's army and so on. And there was a sort of a logic behind it. Now, they were orthodox Marxists, unlike Marx, incidentally. They believed in a version of Marxism that said that revolution can't come in a backward peasant society, which is what Russia was. It was what we would now call a third world country, an undeveloped peasant society with some development, but owned by the West and so on. I mean, a highly educated and productive intellectual class, but that's also true of third world societies. So they thought this couldn't happen. So therefore we have to drive this backward population through industrialization by force, and then later on by the iron laws of history and so on and so forth will come to socialism. Of course, it's all nonsense, but so they essentially laid the basis for a totalitarian system with an ideological doctrine behind it. When the Soviet Union collapsed, I actually wrote an article saying this is a victory for socialism, small victory for socialism. And it just couldn't get published. Nobody knew what it was talking about. The world's two major propaganda systems, the West and the Soviet Union, they both determined to use the word socialism to refer to the totalitarian system of the Soviet Union. I mean, the West did it to discredit socialism. The Bolsheviks did it to try to gain, you know, the credit associated with genuine socialism. Well, when the world's two propaganda systems agree, it's going to be very hard for people to extricate themselves from it. So now socialism, the term has been degraded to mean the form of totalitarianism instituted by Lenin, carried through by Stalin. And I was going back to Spain. It was entirely natural that they should be in the lead in destroying the popular revolution. Bakunin, much earlier, had predicted all of this. He said that in the future, it'll be two forms. One form will be they'll take over the state and they'll create a red bureaucracy, which will be the most vile and brutal regime the world's ever seen. And there are others who will understand that they can't take over the state, so they have to serve concentrated private power and state power. And they'll be the technical intelligentsia who implement the policies of the masters in what we now call liberal democracies, which is a very good prediction. It's one of the few predictions in the social sciences that actually came true, which is one of the reasons why nobody ever studies it. It's much too dangerous and too insightful.
In both the Soviet Union and the United States, ruling elites would set out to master the psyche of the average worker and from the Hawthorne experiments came new insights. Researchers found that the very act of allowing workers to talk about their feelings reduced the possibility of agitation and rebellion. It made workers feel as if they mattered, even if the social relations remained fundamentally the same.
Stephen Sachs, political scientist.
The Hawthorne experiments, initially, it was to be a purely scientific study, and science tries to get rid of unnecessary things. Let's make everything equal so there aren't any other factors than the ones we're controlling for. So they were trying to see what effect changing the lighting would have on how workers felt, and also how much they produced. Wasn't any really quality concern, but quantity of production and worker satisfaction, which can ultimately affect the quantity of work as well. But to do that, they said, well, we don't want to have employees being disgruntled about this and that being a factor. So we will discuss with the employees what we are going to do. There were complete discussions, and the employees would suggest trying this and trying that. And what they found was, no matter what changes they made, including putting the lighting back to where it had been before the experiment began, to see what difference that made, every time they made a change, having discussed it with employees, production went up, and employees' satisfaction went up. Now, if it had been done in a democratic context, immediately the reaction would have been, let's look at the participation. But this was done in a hierarchical context. So what came out of it was a public relations school, industrial relations, developed out of it. And most of that meant was taken as a way of trying to control employees by trying to manipulate them ideologically. Not that managers hadn't done that before, but now there was a whole school of doing that. I would say the wrong lesson was learned. Yeah, put out a suggestion box so that employees can feel they're being asked. But you don't necessarily pay any attention to them. In a real teamwork organization or a participatory organization, employees get to take each other into account. They begin caring about each other. I've seen this going into a plant and seeing it develop over time, the amount of participation increase, and the attitudes of employees begin to grow, and the care that people have about each other. And then that can easily expand to care about the community. And also, work can be reorganized because people have a say. There are better ways to do things. If we are treated better, we'll work better, and so forth. Now, the broader social impact of doing these kinds of things, as we've seen earlier, hierarchical control makes people feel worse about themselves. It creates more mental illness, creates bad relations outside the workplace. Well, if people spend most of their time in a collaborative workplace, they become more collaborative. They care more about each other. You can have a democratic corporation, a worker-owned business, and a worker-owned business that really is managed by the workers, that uses the corporate form. And that gives us some hope because it's possible, at least theoretically, to reform corporations.
Participatory economics is the name for a different way to do the economy. It's a different approach to accomplishing production, consumption, and allocation, economic functions, different than what? Different than capitalism, and different than what went under the name socialism, but I tried to describe as coordinatorism, as this class of engineers and managers and doctors and lawyers being at the top. So participatory economics, or par econ, is an alternative to all of that. It's a different kind of economy. In a participatory economy, in a good economy, instead of organizing economic life to keep a small sector of people on top and to enrich them beyond any sensibility, and to utilize productive apparatus even when it entails doing things that are a complete waste of time, building missiles that will never be used, on and on and on. Instead of all that, we would produce and distribute for purposes of human fulfillment and development. You don't need all the advertising. You need sensible information rather than people competing with advertising that has nothing to do with actually communicating what the benefits and costs of production are. You don't need all this military production. Of course not. You don't need, nor do you want to generate all kinds of activity and product which doesn't make people better off.
As workers around the globe continue to struggle for workplace democracy and equal rights, mass production continues apace. Taylorism, combined with human relations, make up the cornerstones of worker management in the 21st century. In China, scientific management has taken on nightmarish proportions. So extensive is the division of labor that millions of people are forced to perform roughly the same motion thousands of times a day. In the United States, workers in some assembly plants are required to be in continual motion for up to 57 seconds a minute. In Indonesia, sweatshops owned by corporations like Nike chart productivity down to a thousandth of a second. In offices and service industries, corporations are increasingly resorting to video surveillance and computerized monitoring.
And here we must pause Scott Noble's fascinating documentary, Human Resources. More to follow next week. You can find this and several films by Scott Noble at his website, and often on YouTube as well. Noble is distributing them all without charge. Noble's website is www.metanoiafilms.org. That's spelled MetanoiaFilms. Metanoia-films.org. Thanks again to Robin Upton for the radio adaptation, and thanks to you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. In solidarity.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
On today's show, you'll hear the second and final part of a speech given by Willie Rodriguez, who was a janitor working at the World Trade Center on 9/11. And then you'll hear the second part of a speech given by actor Daniel Sunjata about what happens when you speak out about 9/11. And that'll be followed by details on some 9/11 anniversary events. But first, for Willie Rodriguez, the janitor at the World Trade Center, he was in one of the six basement levels of the World Trade Center towers when bombs went off in the basement levels. And this was before the planes hit the building. His personal account of what happened totally shatters the government's version of what happened on 9/11. Willie Rodriguez was interviewed in private by the 9/11 Commission, but his statements were completely omitted from the 9/11 Commission report. We pick up his story here as he's climbing the stairwell trying to save others. So here he is, Willie Rodriguez.
And we didn't know what was going on. So I continue going up and get to the 33rd floor. I find a lady trembling on the floor on a fetal position. She had no shoes. I said, "What are you doing there?" And she said, "I don't know where to go." I stood her up, put her on the stairwell. There were a couple of people coming down. I remember people from the cafeteria of the 44th floor. And I say, "Take her out." And at that moment, on the corridor, I hear something very strange. On the 34th floor, I hear stuff being moved around. And heavy stuff. You know, like those metal dumpsters scratching the floor? Really heavy stuff. Now, why was it strange? Because the 34th floor was a floor that was got out by the construction crew of the World Trade Center, and it was closed. In other words, elevators did not stop there. There was no walls. There's nothing there. And for those people that maybe are not in construction, that's what a building does. When a tenant moves out, they got it out, and they make the money redesigning the place to the specification of the new tenant. So to hear this is the first time that I felt fear on that day. So, of course, I knew somebody was there. So I bypassed that floor and continued to the upper floors. People screaming. People, to this day, I guess the biggest pain and nightmare that I will have is just to hear the screams of people still stuck in the elevator, claiming for help. So I make it to the 39th floor. On the 39th floor, from the opposite side of the stairwell, comes David Lim with two fire chiefs, because they have the white shirts, and we all gathered together to talk about what we were going to do next. And at that moment, bah! We hear the impact of the other tower, and inside of the building, we hear boom, 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 boom. And on the radio, we hear, "We lost 65, we lost 65, meaning the 65th floor collapsed floor by floor by floor up to the 44th floor. We're on the 39th floor, five flights away. And I go into a frenzy, "We got to go up, we got to go up, we got to go up." And David Lim said, "Willie, no, you've done enough, but this is not your job." My mother again. And I say, "What? No, I'm going up." He said, "You're still a civilian, you're my responsibility. Better if you give me a hand with a person on the wheelchair on the 27th floor and get out." He said, "You know, I'm going up." I said, "Please, Willie, just do me that favor." I said, "You know, I'm going to do it, but I'm coming right back." I ran down to the 27th floor. I screamed to the fireman, said, "I have orders to get this guy down right now." The guy was already taken out from the wheelchair, put on a rescue basket, an orange basket, and tied up. And three firemen stood up. So let's go. So we started bringing him down the stairwell. As we go down, we continue listening to small explosions in the building. And all of a sudden, chunks of the ceiling, of the wall, are coming all over us. But it was shiprock. And one of the things that I never forget, it was the building was shifting constantly. So the fluorescent light, the holders, changed position. And you could hear the lights breaking in line all the way down. Pa, 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 pa. So we're like, oh my God, what is this? All of a sudden we hear a huge thump. South Tower collapse. While we're going down the stairwell, we lost balance. We fell. I remember the guy on the rescue basket, because he had one of those masks, looked at us, and I said, don't worry. After this, we're going to go get a beer. And he looks at me and goes like this. And I don't drink. I don't drink. We make it to the lobby. When we get to the lobby, that beautiful marble. How many people have ever been to the World Trade Center? Remember that marble that was on the lobby? Everything was pulled from the wall, and the only thing you saw was the cement patches where the marble was before. So I said, oh God, what is this? A Dantesque scene. I looked to the left, everything was collapsed. The doors of the freight elevators and the passenger elevators on the lobby were open this way, meaning something happened from the bottom and kicked the doors open from the bottom up like this. I said again, God, what's going on? One of the firemen, his name was Regenhardt, looks at me and said, set up the ambulance. So I turned to the right and goes to the West Side Avenue entrance, which was the main entrance to the building. As I go closer, every glass from the area was totally destroyed. There was glass shatter everywhere. Look to the left, the fire safety director area was totally collapsed. And I'm in shock again. I get to the front where the cubicle, not the cubicle, the revolving door was. There was no revolving door, just the empty space. I get to the front, it's right on top of me. And you could hear the whole thing coming down. Boom, boom, boom. And the truck practically getting squashed. I was centimeters from the muffler. I could see the heat, the vapor and everything. And all I remember I said at that moment was, God, please don't give my mother the pain to see my body in pieces. Just let her find my body and recognize it. Because what I saw, all the bodies that I saw, and that's the only thing I asked for. And I knew I was going to die. And I expected death. And as I was there, all of a sudden, this dust came from every orifice under the truck and burns my face, burned my leg on my thigh. I still have the scar. My knee was open. I don't know how. Totally open. And now I know I'm not dying squashed, but I'm going to die of asphyxia because I cannot breathe. And I put my face under I put my shirt right under. And I said, I'm going to die. I'm just going to wait death as much as I can. I was a magician for 30 years. And I used to do the escape tricks that every magician does. The straight jacket escape and everything. So, you know, we always thought that you have to relax, you have to contain your breathing, and that's what I was trying to do. Locally, CNN and Globovision from Brazil were filming from the World Financial Center side, and they said the last person came out right there. And they pointed the area where the rescue effort started, and that's how I was saved that day. Now, they put me out. In the middle, that dust did not disperse for hours. That cloud, and I remember when they pulled me from under, the only thing I could see was the fluorescent lights on the jackets of the firemen, and a flashlight, and a guy screaming, this way, this way. And then I saw the word ambulance backwards. And I went in, stayed there for oxygen for like 15 minutes, came out, this is at the perimeter of Ground Zero. Get out, and the first thing I do is run back to where the truck was, to make sure there was nobody else. When I get there, I was taken out on the nick of time because the tires blew up and the truck completely collapsed. So it was a mission. And I remember looking through the rubble. Remember that bridge that connected the World Financial Center with the World Trade Center, that collapsed on top of several fire trucks. I went under. I found two boots. I put the boots, and I stayed with one leg inside. And that's when I said, I cannot continue doing this. But I stayed in the area until CNN called me, come over here. And I went over there, and I thought, well, my mother probably thinks that I died. Somebody will be able to see me and let her know. So see, I went over there, and I told CNN, totally in shock. You know, I lost all my friends. The Port Authority police officer that was with me, David Lim, died. Everybody died. The person on the wheelchair. The whole story, how I heard an explosion. How was explosions in the building. That went live on national TV all over the world. So what I'm telling you right now is nothing new. It's been out there. After that, I became, of course, because of the media attention, I said, what I do with this? So I said, let's use it to organize the families. And that's why I started fighting for benefits and so on. Now, the good part was that, you see, these people, Felipe David, came out of coma 13 weeks after. Remember, I did not know these people personally. He sees me on NBC talking about the problems with the Red Cross, not giving money to the victims and so on. And he sees me and calls the doctor. He said, that's the guy that saved me. So NBC does a reunion on television, and it was very emotional. Felipe David, his testimony was never heard by the commission, and he was there. Salvatore Giambanco, that's TBN, the Christian Network, doing the encounter on Ground Zero. Sees me on TV, the same thing. That's the guy that saved me. Testimony never heard by the commission either. David Lim survived under the rubble. He was made sergeant after that. He lost his dog. And this is the encounter for Telemundo in New York. So my story started to be validated constantly within months by all these people that were there. And the reason we do this is that we need the truth. We need to find out. When you have Richard Clark coming on national TV and saying, we failed you. We lied to you. Our president failed you. Our government failed you. And you have Condoleezza Rice refusing to testify for the commission. It made it more important to find out the truth. And that's why we do this. We owe this to the victims. I lost 200 friends. 200 friends I'm never going to see again. You know, the emotional inventory that you have to go daily. It's like your whole family is wiped out. So I have to be the voice for those people that don't have the opportunity to talk for themselves, to claim for justice. And that's why I'm going all over the world. Because if here, they don't want to listen, they're listening out there. And they're doing the right thing out there. All we ask is that continue asking questions. The families, the victims, and the survivors believe, and rightly so, because we have been through the whole process of the investigation, that we have been lied to, that they have used our tragedy for a political agenda that we do not agree with, that we have been used to lose our little civil rights that we have left. That movement from the 60s that fought so hard to give us rights is gone. The Patriot Act, one single act, this administration has taken all those rights like that. Congress, Senate, legislature. They're all into it. So we have to fight back. We have to get our rights back, because every time that something happens, when you are more passive and tranquil, you will hear on the news, red alert, orange alert. They got to keep you constantly insecure. They have to control you. They have to control you. They put people on different television programs. Oh, it's okay that they check my bags and check my phone, and if I have nothing to hide and I'm going to feel more secure, I have to give my right to do that to feel more secure. It's okay. What? That doesn't make any sense.
And again, you were just listening to the second and final part of a speech given by Willie Rodriguez, a janitor who worked at the World Trade Center on 9/11. This speech is called What Really Happened on 9/11, and was given in 2006 at a Health and Freedom Conference put on by the Freedom Law School. And now we're going to hear from actor and activist Daniel Sunjata. This is the second and final part of a 2009 interview he did with Marina Portnaya on her program on RT. And RT stands for Russia Today, which, by the way, has recently been taken off the New York City cable stations with no explanation, in another act of media censorship. But now back to the interview. Here he is, actor Daniel Sunjata.
RT's exclusive interview with actor Daniel Sunjata continues as we talk about his unyielding demand for a new 9/11 investigation. You have repeatedly said that anybody who questions the government's version of September 11th is automatically considered a traitor, unpatriotic.
Crazy.
Yet you're still speaking out about this, and you have been speaking out about this issue and about the search for more answers. You're in the public eye. You're an actor. Are you concerned at all about the backlash that you may deal with?
Not really. I'd like to speak to that point that you just made, because mainstream media has pretty much been uniform in its response to celebrities in particular who have taken it upon themselves to speak out about this particular subject. You've got Willie Nelson, Marion Cotillard, Charlie Sheen, Rosie O'Donnell, Ed Asner, and the list goes on, Ed Begley Jr., famous people from the entertainment community who have spoken out about their questions regarding 9/11. Usually the mainstream media's response is to either completely ignore them or to literally call them crazy, call them insane, try to make loose associations between 9/11 Truth, which is a notoriously peaceful movement, although it is a movement of dissent, but a notoriously peaceful movement, to try to make loose connections between 9/11 Truth and terrorism, which Geraldo Rivera did when the Times Square bombing took place. You know, he said, I don't think it was, you know, I think it was probably one of those 9/11 was an inside job kind of guys, protesting kind of like the eco-terrorists, where they don't intend to inflict casualties. To make that kind of a loose association between 9/11 Truth and, you know, terrorism was incredibly irresponsible from a journalistic standpoint, and to do so without ever having really entertained the arguments being put forth by 9/11 truthers was intellectually disingenuous, to say the very least. You know, I think it says a lot, and I will use Charlie Sheen as the most recent and probably best example. Charlie Sheen penned a letter to President Obama called 20 Minutes with the President, where he essentially asks for 20 minutes with President Obama to ask him questions on behalf of the victims' family members regarding 9/11, unanswered questions. And he cites, he has 20 bullet points in this letter to President Obama, and each one of these bullet points is supported in a bibliography that contains relatively uncontroversial news sources. And these are not like, the questions that he's asking are not crazy questions. It's not like holographic planes or beams from outer space having brought down the buildings. I mean, these are like really kind of nuts and bolts, inconsistencies and contradictions that he wanted the president to address. Now, Geraldo Rivera came out and called him crazy. There's somebody on Fox and Friends whose name I can't remember, Gutfeld or something like that, who called him a Nazi. You know, all kinds of ad hominem responses to a fact-based argument. And that, I think, is very telling. I think it means that somebody does not want to address the subject of 9/11 based upon the facts at hand. They want to respond with character assassination and personal insults, you know, on The View, which is not really the news. Meghan McCain responded to Charlie Sheen's 20 Minutes with the President initiative by saying, are you really going to take your political cues from an actor? Clearly not remembering that Ronald Reagan was president of the United States and Arnold Schwarzenegger is governor of the state of California. So that's not really a very substantive rebuttal to the questions that Charlie has raised either. As a matter of fact, he has yet to be substantively addressed, you know, based upon what he has put forward. And I'm kind of not surprised.
In the last investigation, Bush and Cheney agreed to testify only behind closed doors, not under oath, and with no audio taping, no videotaping, nothing. Would you like to see them questioned again under oath?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I would. I mean, we've addressed a lot of kind of crimes of omission, things that by virtue of the fact that they didn't happen seem to say a lot, and I think that that's a great example of that. I mean, doesn't that smack of guilt or of evasion? I mean, look, just the fact that it took 441 days for them to launch the what later became the 9/11 Commission, when under similar circumstances, after Pearl Harbor, after the Kennedy assassination, after other traumatic events that happened on American soil, commissions were kicked off almost immediately. Investigations were started almost immediately. 9/11, 441 days. And then when you finally get Bush and Cheney to sit down and answer a couple questions, they'll do it only under oath. And if they can have their, you know, if they can sit next to their accomplice and make sure that they have their story straight, I mean, it just doesn't look good. What are they hiding?
How does it change? What do Americans have to do to cause a change? Because we have a president that's in the White House right now that campaigned on change and promised change.
I think what we have to do is we have to not sit back and assume that because Barack Obama got elected that things are necessarily going to change. I mean, we have to remember that there's a certain responsibility that comes with living in a democracy or in a country that aspires to the democratic ideal. Government by, of, and for the people, that insinuates that you must participate in your government, that you have to demand accountability, that you have to ask questions, that you have to participate in the governmental process. Now, I say that, but here we are talking about the NYC CAN petition, where you have 80,000 people who are trying to do just that, and the state of New York seems to be blocking their attempts to participate in the process of governing themselves.
In 2009, the 9/11 Truth Movement was working on an effort to get a new investigation into 9/11 by petitioning the New York City Council. It was called NYC CAN, or New York Coalition for Accountability Now. The effort ultimately failed, but was one of many efforts by the 9/11 Truth Movement to have accountability and the truth of what happened on 9/11. Today, we have a more sophisticated effort to get that investigation through a grand jury petition filed in April of 2018 to the court in New York City by the group called the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. The court had 90 days to respond to this petition, but to date, they have not. The Lawyers Committee is working on the next phase of this grand jury petition, and if you want to support them, you can do that by signing their petition, and you can do this by going to their website, which is www.lawyerscommitteefor9-11inquiry.org. So that's, again, Lawyers Committee for 9-11inquiry.org. And the 9 and 11 are the numbers, the digits, not spelled out. You can even see the full grand jury petition with all of the evidence they cite. And that leads right into the 17th anniversary 9/11 events that are planned on and around September 11th, 2018 to commemorate the 17th anniversary. The Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry will be holding an event September 10th in New York City. Several Lawyers Committee attorneys will be speaking at the Jefferson Market Public Library to inform our citizens and explain the recent and upcoming legal actions. The event will also be live streamed at noliesradio.org. So you can go to noliesradio.org and get a live stream ticket to see that event if you can't make it to New York City on September 10th. And again, it was at the Jefferson Memorial Library. And you can learn more about this by going to the Lawyers Committee website. Also, the Lawyers Committee on September 11th will be in Washington, D.C., and the executive director, Mick Harrison, will speak at an event organized by Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth between 2 and 4 p.m. at the nation's capital. This event will also be live streamed, and you can also get that at noliesradio.org. And it's right up on their front page, so you can't miss it at noliesradio.org. To find out more about these events, again, the Lawyers Committee website is www.lawyerscommitteefor9-11inquiry.org. There will also be local events around the country and around the world supporting the Lawyers Committee and their grand jury petition. And we will have a local event here on Tuesday, September 11th, in West Hartford Center from 5:30 to 7. And it will be right on the corner of North Main Street and Farmington Avenue. And again, that's Tuesday, September 11th at 5:30. Please join us if you can. You know, sometimes people have said that it's disrespectful to the victims' family members of 9/11 to hold 9/11 truth events on and around the anniversary. But it was actually the victims' family members who believed that we were being lied to about 9/11 and lobbied Congress relentlessly and through media attention for them doing this, forced the 9/11 Commission into existence. And they were totally disappointed with the 9/11 Commission report and the cover-up that it appears to be. But they often take part in these 9/11 truth events, and they support the quest for a new investigation.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Alma Labong is on a U.S. tour to build support for Filipino workers under attack by the Duterte regime by pressuring the U.S. to cut off military aid for the Philippines. 30 labor leaders have been killed since Duterte became president. Others have been jailed on trumped-up charges as the conditions for workers deteriorated.
Masses of workers have been forced to strike because public and private employers are only giving workers temporary employment that lasts less than 6 months, and they're terminated short of being eligible for regular benefits. Strike picket lines have been busted up by the police, who beat workers and round them up to jail.
And we're extremely pleased to have with us Alma Labong, who's the chairperson of the Kilosang Mayo Uno KMU Labor Federation, also known as the KMU May 1st Labor Center. And it is an honor to have you with us.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity.
Alma, the introduction that we gave before highlighted two drastic conditions in the Philippines, one involving the condition of contractualization of labor, and the other is increased repression of labor by the state. Both of those, we might want to take a case study. Both of those were manifested in the case of NutraAsia. This is one among many firms. So do you want to talk about that and how these tendencies were displayed in that case?
Yeah, actually, during the elections, Mr. Duterte promised to altogether junk the contractualization scheme in the Philippines, and indeed there were high expectations from the ranks of labor. In fact, we've undergone a lot of dialogues with government, particularly with Mr. Duterte, to push on the demand to make true his electoral promise. And indeed, even on the last May Day, he promised that if we come up with a draft of the executive order, then he will just be signing this in its entirety. But then again, instead of coming out with the version that we were expecting, it was a shallow version of the junking of the contractualization scheme that came out. So, nevertheless, despite this, there are positive orders given out by the Department of Labor calling on companies, including NutraAsia, to implement regularization of their workers. In fact, the Philippine long-distance telephone company was ordered to regularize 12,000. The Coca-Cola plant in Santa Rosa, Laguna, was ordered to regularized 657 workers. Jollibee chain of restaurants was asked to regularize 8,000, and so on and so forth. So, in all these orders, what the capitalists would usually do is to either transfer the workforce or fire them all at once. And so, this has created a lot of contradiction. And that's one of them is NutraAsia, where workers were asserting the regularization of contractual workers. So there's an opening of the floodgates that led to various forms of struggles, including strikes, like the NutraAsia case, because of this failed promise of the president. And so we are in a situation now where the number of actual conflicts had reached up to 31, including those in Mindanao. And as I left the country, there were about more or less 200 notices of strikes that were filed with the Labor Department. So it's a volatile situation that invites a lot of the caps in picket lines, especially in areas where there are they are far from cities. One of the terrible impact of this is that they wanted to make it appear that our members in the banana plantations are NPA surrenderees, and that They are bona fide, card-bearing, dues-paying members of our organization. And yet the military wanted to manipulate the situation, especially in a case where Mindanao is still under the effect of martial law.
Elmer Labong, could you first just go back for a moment and tell us more about the overall conditions of the Filipino workers and really situate that within the advent of the Duterte administration, just to give us a kind of context for the particular struggles that are going on?
Yeah, first of all, our because of the issue of contractualization, this is a major demand of the labor movement in the Philippines to regularize contractual workers who have been serving companies for several decades already. And so this is in consonance with the president's promise to stop contractualization. In fact, the practice of firing workers after 5 months of work, which we call endo in the slang, which in the labor language means end of contract, is one of those that we fought for, meaning workers should be regularized after 6 months. And so what the employers do is before reaching 6 months, they would fire their workers. And this has been a prevailing practice for quite some time. So that's the number one issue we have, and this is coupled with the low wages that we have. So since wages are regionalized, the highest wage level is about a little over 10 U.S. dollars or 502 pesos a day plus 10 pesos allowance in Metro Manila. So as you go farther away from Metro Manila, the wages are much, much lower. We are demanding for the increase of wages in the light that the current prices of commodities and services keep rising, especially with the implementation of the tax reform law at present, which is called TRAIN, or the Tax Reform Acceleration and Inclusion Act, or Republic Act 109-63, which technically imposes taxation on various items and services in order to affect the implementation of the project of the government, which is called Build Infrastructure Program. In the process, taxing especially products that uses sugar in its products like beverages. So these are the facts that are prevailing and the current situation in the Philippines. Our wages are low, but the inflation rate is too high, like currently it's 6.6% already and is still going high. The prices of oil and oil products keeps increasing almost every week, but the level of wages still remains low. So as we assert our rights to better working conditions through regularization of the contractual workforce and fight for higher wages, this is where the conflict comes with the police, because generally the companies summons the police and use goons to disperse the workers every time we assert such a right. One of the positive conditions that we were able to attain for the past several months already, beyond May Day, is the unification of all labor groups towards the fight for regularization of contractual workers.
And by the way, Elmer, let me just interrupt you. What kind of work are we talking about? What kind of jobs are these?
These are jobs that are not regular, meaning...
No, I understand, but what do they do? Are they manufacturing jobs? Are they...
They're various, so you see them in services, in manufacturing, and also in agriculture. This is where the dominant contractual workers are. So contractuals are in government and in the private sector.
So it's across the spectrum. It's public sector and private.
Across all sectors of the labor movement. Like one in every three government workers are contractuals, and three out of five in private sector are likewise contractuals. So even the so-called core functions of companies are farmed out to non-regular workforce or the contractual workers. So practically 70% of the total labor force are contractual workers. This explains why there is a massive reduction of the membership of the unions and thus paying aspect of the labor force. In terms of our organizing.
In terms of the police repression, because you mentioned the goons coming in from the outside, but people are being beat by the cops, aren't they, and also hauled off to jail. And you mentioned to me also in a prior discussion that 30 trade union leaders have been killed in the last year or so.
Yes, since Duterte took power, there were already 31 cases of killings of labor leaders and organizers all over the country. And a testimony to this, for example, aside from the killings, is the illegal arrest of organizers and leaders of my organization, like one of our organizers who had been assigned to fight for, against the phase-out of jeepneys, had been singled out by the military, and the trump-up charges were filed against him, like he was being charged of murder of people in Mindanao, whereas he never been in that place. And when he was arrested by the police in order to keep him detained, they planted a handgun. And this is bailable, but in order to contain, to avoid the, being able to post bail, they planted a hand grenade as an evidence. So since this is an explosive device, then it's not a bailable offense. So it's still kept on in isolation till the present time.
We're speaking with Elma Lebon, who is the chairperson of the KMU May 1st Labor Center in the Philippines, Kilusang Mayo Uno Labor Federation. I just wanted to also ask you about a little bit about the structure and the nature of your organization in response to, is it a representative organization of all these different sectors of the economy?
It is a representation of the cross-section of the labor movement, like we have members in agriculture, in the semiconductor industry, drug and food line, the some textile and garments, also in various services in the Philippines. To name a few of our members, we have them in the Magnolia plant, which is a member of the San Miguel conglomerate. We have the former Philips, which is NXP. We have Wyatt, which has been bought by Nestle, and other multinational corporations like those in the banana plantation under the Sumitomo Fruits Corporation. MIFRO, which I have mentioned, have been victims of the forced surrenders by the military. So we cut across various segments of different industries in the country.
And you are here And I want to make that connection. You were here on a U.S. tour to build support for Philippine workers who are under attack by the Duterte regime by pressuring the U.S. to cut off military aid for the Philippines. Talk about the relationship and what role the U.S. has as it relates to the oppression and repression of the workforce of the Philippines.
The U.S. government funds the Philippine military and police to a staggering amount of about $175 million. And this fund that comes from U.S. people's tax is being used to buy armaments to maim the very people that they're supposed to defend under the Constitution. And so without this big fund being released by the Philippine by the U.S. Government to the Philippine military and police, then they wouldn't have the ability to buy the armaments that they would use against their very own people.
And how large is that military aid? What are we talking about?
Like about $175 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so this has been used to for the anti-terrorism campaign of the military, Philippine military, through the guidance and advice of the U.S. Pentagon. And so they implement the anti-terrorism program, but in the process, even the legitimate people's organization are branded as terrorist organizations like mine. And so there is disrespect, a blanket disrespect of the human rights, trade union, as well as human rights of people in the Philippines. That's why we're calling on the United States workers to lobby the government to stop funding the Duterte government in its war on drugs, but which extends beyond that. In fact, through these funds, they keep on killing people just because they are under the influence or they use drugs, meaning they immediately eliminate people whom they identify as being indulged in the use or sale of drugs, like even hardened criminal, to our point of view, should be given their day in court. And so even these drug users should likewise be given their right or the day in court, not just saying that the usual excuse of the police is that they fought back every time. It's an overused sentence already, that they were intending to arrest the suspect and he fought back. So this is an overused sentence in the Philippines in terms of the campaign against the drug menace.
And another dimension, I assume, is the increased surveillance by the police and the military of trade unions and other political establishment organizations.
Yes, in fact, the attacks against the union organizers has not been just confined to the KMU, but this is also happening to other organizations as well, which has joined the broad alliance to assert the regularization of contractual workers. Indeed, in many cases, we have been able to observe that there are state agents watching our offices, and in one or two cases, our staff would go after them and ask for their identification. They would scamper away, and we know that there are backup vehicles around, and it's really dangerous to accost them just there and then, without having a big number of people to do this. It's a dangerous situation. And so we make it a point that we do not just move around alone. We go in tandems, in groups, so to avoid being kidnapped while moving from one place to another. And we see to it that our assemblies and meetings are then most of the time outside of Metro Manila, so that the surveillance would be lesser compared to when we are within the city, where it's easier to make surveillance through the modern equipments and gadgets that would be easily used to eavesdrop whatever plans and programs that we intend to do at any given time. And so we keep this vigilance because we know that the situation is worse than it was under Marcos.
I'd like to ask you about that. If you can talk about how it's worse and what the Duterte regime really means for the peoples of the Philippines, and then give us the message in the time that we have left about what we need to do to work with our sisters and brothers in the Philippines to stop aid to the Duterte military and police.
Yeah, it's worse because there were 3,500 killings, extrajudicial executions during Marcos' over 30-year reign. But in the case of Duterte, in just a period of 2 years, there were already more than 20,000 people killed. So it's a combination of his anti-drug war, and that extends beyond the ranks of activists. And so he confuses things now and lies to people and say that this is still his drug war, but indeed it extends beyond that. So that makes it dangerous. That is why we said that the Duterte regime is Marcos, Arroyo, and Duterte rolled into one. If you read that the names, it would come out that it's and the word would be mad. So that's how we describe how dangerous the situation is. And because of this, it is really important that we hear voices from other countries, especially workers that are based in the U.S., to lobby the U.S. Congress and top politicians not to send more aid in the Philippines, as these tax people's tax money are being used to attack the very people that are supposed to be the ones to be defended against attacks. So I think this is one urgent thing to propagate publicly what's happening now in the Philippines. Things are not really good. There's so much oppression and exploitation, especially in Mindanao, where martial law is still being imposed, and there is no end at sight for Duterte to end it, even at the end of this year. So it is a de facto martial law imposition in Metro Manila, because even if it's not formally imposed, we could feel the impact of martial law being imposed there by sowing fear, not just in the ranks of the basic sectors of society like workers, but it cuts across even beyond the middle class, and especially even amongst the religious sector in Philippine society.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there with the admonition to all of our listeners to let your legislators know that we want to support our Filipino workers, our brothers and our sisters, by cutting off military aid to the Duterte administration. And thank you very much, Alma Labong, chairperson of the Kilosong Mayo Uno, the KMU May 1st Labor Center, for the work that you do, for speaking to us with this special. And we're going to try to keep in more frequent touch to see how things are doing and to make sure that we lend our voice to stopping the repression of workers in the Philippines.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity, and more power to your program.
More power to the people, the workers of the Philippines. Thank you for joining us.
These government workers risk life and limb, making sure commuters can drive safely on this highway. But when they do lose a limb, or life for that matter, they get no compensation.
We get nothing from the government. We only get donations from our co-workers. They'll give us a dollar or two each, and that's it.
They're what's known as job order workers. They're hired for 6 months at a time, and get no additional benefits apart from their daily wages. In the private sector, the equivalent is a so-called contractual employee.
One of the major campaign promises of President Rodrigo Duterte, and one of the factors that most likely got him elected, was an end to temp hiring, or what's known here as ENDO. ENDO is short for end of contract. Now, what it is the practice of companies of hiring employees for only a few months, typically 5 or 6 months. Critics say this is a way for companies to save money by skirting their responsibility to give workers social and health care benefits required under the law for regular employees.
Labor and business groups agree ENDO is illegal, but labor union leaders want more. They say Duterte promised to adopt a policy of direct hiring, but that his executive order prohibiting, quote, illegal contract and subcontract hiring does not do enough.
Just to say that the regulations are very loose.
Because our labor laws are very loose and easy to circumvent, employers will still be able to hire contractual workers. So we need a policy where direct hiring is the norm and third-party hiring is the exception.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
The 5'2", 105-pound shepherd had been severely beaten, burned, and tied to a fence post in near freezing temperatures.
So-called family values organizations spend millions of dollars promoting that homosexuality is an abhorrent behavior that can and should be changed.
This is what I was trying to stop. This is exactly why I did what I did.
God hates fags. Why is that so hard for you guys to understand?
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle.
And I'm Greg Gordon. Taiwan voters face dueling marriage referenda.
Uganda's ethics minister calls queer safe space a crime.
And remembering Matthew Shepard 20 years on.
Those stories and more this week because you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Brian DeShazer.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending October 13, 2018. Taiwan's Constitutional Court declared in May last year that civil marriage should be open to same-gender couples. The justices gave the legislative yuan up to 2 years to change relevant laws. If they failed to do so, the ruling said, marriage equality would automatically become the law of the land. Lawmakers have resisted taking action as strident opposition grows from the conservative Christian umbrella group calling itself the Happiness of the Next Generation Alliance. They gathered more than enough signatures on petitions to qualify 3 separate referenda earlier this month, one to confirm that civil marriage is exclusively heterosexual, another to offer same-gender couples less than equal civil unions instead of marriage, and a third asking if LGBTQ subject matter should be taught in public schools. They are, of course, opposed. Led by the Taiwan Alliance to Promote Civil Partnership Rights, equality activists appear to have succeeded in qualifying a competing referendum to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. So Taiwan voters will have to decide which of the 4 referenda to approve. They'll go to the polls on November 24th, when Taiwanese citizens were already scheduled to vote for candidates in regional elections.
A referendum cannot overturn a constitutional court ruling, but according to media reports, the government is required to propose laws that match referenda outcomes. So the government would need to propose a marriage equality law or some kind of civil unions law, depending on the referenda results. There could be yet another lawsuit if a civil unions law is ultimately enacted instead of the court-ordered marriage equality.
In a related story, press reports this week suggested that Romania's government would be introducing legislation to create civil unions for same-gender couples. It follows the stunning rejection last week of a referendum there, also pushed by conservative Christian forces, to enshrine hetero-only marriage in the socially conservative country's constitution. The proposal required the participation of at least 30% of eligible voters to take effect, but, perhaps heeding the call by equality advocates to stay home, just 20% of eligible voters went to the polls.
Uganda's Minister for Ethics and Integrity, Simon Lokoto, said this week that Rainbow Riots, an activist group planning to establish a safe space center for LGBTQ people in Kampala, would be an illegal act. They will have to take it somewhere else, Lokoto said, adding that homosexuality is not allowed and completely unacceptable in Uganda. Same-gender sex in the East African nation is a criminal act under colonial-era laws, punishable by up to life in prison. After months of planning and fundraising, organizers at Rainbow Riots say they'll continue working on their project. It would be the first queer center in the region. Trans activist Alicia Houston told Gay Star News that, Lokoto's condemnation cannot stop us. This center is not a criminal act. Entrenched Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni claimed at a rally earlier this year that outsiders were trying to import oral sex into his country. The mouth is for eating, he said, not for sex. Attempts to hold a simple pride event in Kampala have usually been banned in advance by government authorities or shut down by security police. So Rainbow Riots no doubt has a difficult road ahead.
A second annual LGBTQ Pride March filled the streets of Pristina, the capital of Kosovo, on October 10th. A far-right political party had called for the Parade of Shame to be banned, but it went ahead without incident under the slogan of In the Name of Freedom. Kosovo's first Pride March was successfully held last year. Prime Minister Ramush Haradinaj posted his support for this year's event on Facebook, writing that sexual orientation is up to the individual and should be respected, and that LGBT and Pride Week will always have institutional support to be free and secure to express their orientation. A number of government officials and members of foreign embassies joined the mayor of Pristina and several hundred LGBTQ activists and allies in the march, which was guarded by a large number of police officers and security forces. Homosexuality is a difficult subject in the socially conservative, mostly Muslim, Balkan nation. As part of its effort to join the European Union, Kosovo has a law protecting LGBTQ people from discrimination, but it's not always enforced, and same-gender couples have no legal rights.
Tokyo wants to put its best foot forward ahead of hosting the 2020 Summer Olympics. The city's Metropolitan Assembly took one of those steps this week by approving an LGBTQ anti-discrimination ordinance that specifically targets hate speech. Officials will monitor public spaces, like city parks, to shut down hate rhetoric by anti-queer groups. It also commits Tokyo officials to conducting LGBTQ rights education programs. The ordinance reportedly includes steps to improve access by same-gender couples to mutual hospital visitation. The city will also host an Olympics Pride House during the 2020 Games and Paralympics. While the conservative federal government lags behind growing public support for basic anti-discrimination protections and legal recognition for same-gender couples, 8 cities and city wards have passed local measures that allow queer couples to register their unions. Those registrations allow them hospital visitation and a few other rights that heterosexual couples in Japan take for granted.
This court has held that nobody should be forced to have or express a political opinion in which he does not believe.
That's Lady Hale, the president of the United Kingdom's Supreme Court, announcing the much-anticipated ruling in the UK's very own Gay Cake case. This one pitted queer activist Gareth Lee against Belfast's Asher's Bakery. It started 4 years ago when Lee asked the bakery to make a cake that depicted Sesame Street's rumored gay couple, Bert and Ernie, with the slogan, Support Gay Marriage. Northern Ireland is the only part of the United Kingdom without marriage equality. Lee told reporters after the ruling was announced that he was made to feel like a second-class citizen when Daniel MacArthur, who owns the bakery with his wife Amy, refused to make the cake for him on religious grounds.
I'm concerned not just for the implications for myself or other gay people, but for every single one of us.
The court was careful to distinguish the difference between this case, however, and the high-profile Masterpiece Cake Shop case in the United States. Asher's Bakery would have refused to supply this particular cake to anyone, whatever their personal characteristics, so there was no discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation. Cake maker MacArthur celebrated the ruling, which overturned lower court decisions.
The judges have given a clear signal today. In fact, it couldn't be clearer. Family businesses like ours are free to focus on giving all their customers the best service they can without being forced to promote other people's campaigns.
While some LGBTQ activists condemned the ruling, Australian-born but British-based human rights activist Peter Tatchell tended to agree with MacArthur during an interview with his native country's PM program.
Let's put things in reverse. I wouldn't feel happy with a gay baker being forced by law to decorate a cake with a message against gay marriage. This is just a judgment that people should not be compelled against their wishes to promote messages and ideas with which they disagree.
In an interesting twist, a photography company rejected the business of the Christian Institute, the notoriously anti-queer group that bankrolled the Asher's Bakery appeal. The company had accepted a deposit from the Institute to provide photography services outside the court following the announcement of the ruling. After learning the details of the case, however, the company refused service and refunded the deposit. Tony Hsu of the online agency through which the Institute booked the photographer told Pink News that the High Court affirmed that companies could do that if they feel that it goes against their morals. We appreciate that this looks like tit for tat. And it is.
And finally, the diminutive plaintiff in the U.S. Supreme Court case that overturned DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, a prelude to the High Court's subsequent ruling that opened civil marriage to same-gender couples, has been honored in her hometown of Philadelphia. If you don't know who she was, check out her story online. Edie Windsor Way, the new street sign for the block between Walnut and Locust Streets in what's known as the city's Gayborhood, was unveiled on October 7th. The irrepressible Windsor died in September 2017 at the age of 88 after virtually becoming the poster person for marriage equality in the U.S. Reacting to her passing last year, former President Barack Obama said that few were as small in stature as Edie Windsor, and few made as big a difference to America. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed a proclamation earlier this year declaring June 20th, Windsor's birthday, as Edie Windsor Day. Quoting one of the slogans in the campaign for renaming the street sign, a Facebook posting celebrated the unveiling with, "Don't postpone joy today. Take a stroll the Edie Windsor way."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending October 13th, 2018. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazor, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the always updated thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazor.
And I'm John Dyer V.
Hello, this is Judy Shepherd, the mother of Matthew Shepherd. And you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio magazine for all our sexually diverse communities.
When Matthew Shepherd died on October 12, 1998, his murder became an international emblem of senseless homophobic hatred. As the world observes the 20th anniversary of the tragedy and its aftermath, we revisit our extended report from October 19, 1998. I offered some closing thoughts after This Way Out's Greg Gordon narrated our original reading of the Book of Matthew.
This is Buda Valley Hospital with the final update on Matthew Shepherd, Monday, October 12th. Matthew died shortly before 1 a.m. today as a result of injuries he sustained last week.
At dozens of unprecedented marches, memorial services, and candlelight vigils held across the U.S. last week, with more scheduled in the coming week, gays and lesbians and a number of non-gay people have reacted to the brutal gay-bashing death of University of Wyoming student Matthew Shepherd with shock, grief, and anger. We'll visit Washington, D.C., West Hollywood, California, and Madison, Wisconsin to sample some of those events and pay our respects, unlike a handful of religious extremists, at Matthew's funeral in Casper, Wyoming. But we begin with the details of the crime itself and some of the issues it raises in this report by Verna Avery Brown.
In what appears to have been an anti-gay hate crime, the 5-foot, 2-inch, 105-pound Shepherd had been severely beaten, burned, and tied to a fence post in near-freezing temperatures last Wednesday outside Laramie, Wyoming. State officials now say two men, Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson, will face murder charges for the attack, and their girlfriends are likely to be charged as accessories. The father of one of the suspects told the Denver Post that his son, Aaron McKinney, never set out to kill Shepherd, but instead wanted to get back at Shepherd for making a pass at his son in front of his friends at a campus bar.
I find it hard to believe that he would do that if he had not been led to believe that the individuals were gay.
Jim Osborne, chair of the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgendered Association, a group established as a safe haven on campus for gays and lesbians.
Matt was a kind, caring, respectful individual. He was not flirtatious, or he was not the type of guy to go out and look for a one-night stand. That just was not Matt.
Wyoming is one of 9 states that have not passed hate crime legislation. Wyoming Governor Jim Geringer, who in the past has neither supported nor opposed such bills, revisited the issue.
We're very open to changing our law where it's not strict enough or where it's not comprehensive enough. We could enhance penalties, but how do you enhance the penalty when a death has occurred? If capital punishment is the result, how do you enhance that? Our laws already cover that. So I'm not sure what we would add.
The point is not all bias crimes are murders.
Wyoming State Legislator Mike Massey is co-sponsor of the bias crime bill, which has failed several times in the state legislature.
This one was terrible, but it's not the only type of bias crimes that occur in Wyoming, just like anywhere else in the country. It occurs day in and day out. An African-American man one time was run off his bicycle up near Jackson. Some teachers who are minority teachers have had desks thrown at them by students. And I would imagine that 90% of the bias crimes don't end up in murder. And as a result, an enhanced penalty would have quite an effect.
Lori Jean of the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center says at least some of the responsibility for the rising violence against gays and lesbians rests with the bogus cure claims of the religious right.
So-called family values organizations spend millions of dollars on anti-gay campaigns promoting that homosexuality is an abhorrent behavior that can and should be changed, that are viewed as quackery by every reputable medical establishment from the American Medical Association on down. Campaigns which help to foster an environment that allows some people to kill another person simply because he is gay.
We were incredibly shocked and disgusted at the Matthew Shepard death and the way that he was killed.
Tony Verona, legal counsel with the Human Rights Campaign, the country's largest lesbian-gay political group.
But what is most sad is that we were not surprised, given that gay people are at the brunt of anti-gay hate crimes all the time. They are actually, I think it's something like 12% of all reported hate crimes are anti-gay hate crimes. So there are hundreds and thousands of Matthews out there that are victims of hate crimes or are no longer with us, given that they have been killed just because they had the courage to say, I am gay or I am lesbian.
We have to have the will of our political leaders to get into the high schools.
Again, Lori Jean.
That's where we need to be doing the education. And the instant you start talking about doing education in the high schools, that will prevent youth from committing anti-gay hate crimes. There are some people who get scared, but that's where we've got to start.
You're listening to a commemoration of the 20th anniversary of the death of Matthew Shepard.
We are here to express three equally important emotions: terrible sorrow, deep anger, and absolute and unshakable determination.
Openly gay Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts, pioneering comedian Ellen DeGeneres, and Shepard's best friend Walter Bowden were among the speakers at a candlelight vigil held on the steps of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C.
There are people who make excuses for these murderers. There are people who will go to the polls and vote against a violent hate crime statute and against allowing the schools to play the role they ought to play in fighting this vicious prejudice. And the sad fact is they will go to the polls in greater number than many of us will. So one of the things you can do between now and November is this: make sure that you and everyone who cares for you, everyone who expresses to you their horror and sympathy and disgust at this brutal murder, make sure that they take the time and trouble between now and November to find out the position on gay and lesbian fairness and equality of every single individual on that ballot and get out there, and we can protect ourselves with our vote in November.
I know we all feel the same way, and I'm here, and I'm, you know, he's got his two close friends here, and I don't even know him, and I'm thinking this is just really selfish of me. I mean, what, pull yourself together, and it just hit me why I am so devastated by it. It's because this is what I was trying to stop. This is exactly why I did what I did.
Just a week before he was so savagely tortured and murdered, Matt told me how happy he was to be back home, how comfortable he felt in Laramie, and how safe he felt there compared to the big city. I was so happy to hear that because I had encouraged Matt to come home. Matt's sense of safety was betrayed by every legislator in Wyoming and in this nation who has ever opposed or voted against hate crime legislation over the last year.
Comments by some of those participating in a candlelight vigil in West Hollywood, California, reflected the anger and renewed fears felt everywhere.
I've been thrown eggs at walking down the street. I've been
bashed all through my, you know, childhood at school.
It really limits me. I can't be affectionate in public. It's gotten to the point that, you know, people that I have been with have been complaining, you know, you're not affectionate, you're not affectionate. And I'm afraid to be. It depresses me sometimes. And I think, God, you know, I said, why do I have to be this way? And then I think, no, why do they have to be that way?
I'm upset and saddened by what happened to this young boy, but I'm also angered by the fact that we have leaders in our Congress that equate us to kleptomaniacs. And I believe that those people are really responsible as much as the two men and the two girls that were charged. Those people in our Congress that support this kind of hatred, even though they may not support the violence, they support the hatred.
The march and rally in Madison, Wisconsin, exemplified the reaffirmation of community that was also widely expressed.
Less than 2 days after University of Wyoming student Matthew Shepard died from wounds suffered in a horrific gay bashing, hundreds gathered on the library mall at the University of Wisconsin to express anger, grief, and a resolve that the climate of hatred and fear that produced his death must end. On a windy, cold Wisconsin night, people young and old, gay and straight, drew warmth and comfort from one another. Holding each other tight and bathed in the light of candles, they marched solemnly up State Street, their ranks stretching for several blocks, a portrait of Matthew Shepard held high above the crowd.
All I can think of is the importance of our honesty, of our openness, of our visibility, of us using our voices to speak loudly and clearly and unequivocally about who we are and supporting one another. Silence is death.
Concluded, and several dozen of us lingered in the dark and cold. We were reminded of the source of our strength, the special sense of love and community that we share. At the base of the Capitol steps was a makeshift monument to Matthew, built around his portrait, elegant and eloquent in its simplicity. One by one, as people left the rally, they added their candles to a glowing assemblage. Clustered around it, our bodies blocked the wind, allowing the candles to burn brightly, even while we basked in the warmth of their glow. This is John Quinlan reporting.
We should try to remember that because Matt's last few minutes of consciousness on Earth may have been hell, his family and friends want more than ever to say their farewells to him in a peaceful, dignified, and loving manner.
God hates fags. Why is that so hard for you guys to understand?
A handful of religious extremists from Kansas and Texas ignored what seemed like a simple request by Matthew's father, Dennis Shepard, before the funeral in Casper, Wyoming on October 16, 1998, during which one of Matthew's cousins read a poem she had written for him to say goodbye.
He lived in shame, he died in shame. I mean, it's not okay to be gay. I mean, it's a soul-damning, nation-destroying lifestyle.
If you guys don't recognize him as a human being, then you don't need to be out here.
We're offended that the state of Wyoming and the governor would say to this public school system here in Casper, Wyoming, to fly their flags at half-mast to honor this sodomite.
I think it is so disrespectful to come to a young man's funeral.
On behalf of our son, Matthew Shepard, we want to thank the citizens of the United States and the people of the world who have expressed their deepest sympathy and condolences to our family during these trying times. A person as caring and loving as our son Matt would be overwhelmed by what this incident has done to the hearts and souls of people around the world. Matthew was the type of person that, if this had happened to another person, would have been the first on the scene to offer his help, his hope, and his heart to the family.
Maddie, I love you with all of my heart. I wish you only knew how much. You'll be happier with this brand new start. The world's hearts you now have touched.
of the lingering questions that surrounds the death of Matthew Shepard is, why now? Why has the hate murder of a young gay man gone to the hearts of so many across the country when so many deadly bias crimes go unnoticed? Some say that it is the increased visibility of gays and lesbians as real people rather than stereotypes. Some credit it to Shepard's innocent boy-next-door persona, contrasted with the unsettling image of the scarecrow lashed to a fence. Some point out that neither of these rationales are proof of a newfound compassion for gays and lesbians. Instead, they betray the still deep-seated biases against the other in our society. The measure by which people qualify as real is relative, and the privileged white college student does not, in fact, live next door to everybody. Perhaps the real question is why the murder of Matthew Shepard attracted the attention of the national mainstream media. People cannot react to a situation they do not know about, and few of the violent homophobic hate crimes that happen week after week, month after month, receive the spotlight granted the Shepard case. Perhaps it is the media that determines whose horror is horrible enough to reach an audience already numbed to the run-of-the-mill blood and gore, already set in its ways regarding who will be a victim deserving of sympathy. And perhaps, if more of the faces on the statistics of anti-lesbian hate crime passed muster for America's television cameras, there would be an outpouring of commitment to stop the violence, rather than an all-too-easily-forgotten outpouring of tears for a single slaughtered human symbol in Wyoming.
That was Lucia Chappell with some immediate thoughts about the meaning of the Matthew Shepard tragedy in October 1998. 20 years after his death, Wyoming remains one of 5 U.S. states without a hate crimes law. Despite the enactment of the federal Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act of 2009 that Judy and Dennis Shepard fought to pass, 15 states that do have anti-hate laws still do not include crimes against LGBTQ people.
With violence against trans women of color in particular skyrocketing during the Trump administration, the Shepherds have continued their anti-hate work through the Matthew Shepard Foundation and the online youth resource Matthew's Place. On the 20th anniversary of their son's death, they announced that his ashes will at last be interred at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. His parents want the site of Matthew's remains to provide a place for people to reflect on the ravages of hate and where it will have much-needed protection from desecration by haters.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from John Dyer V and Brian DeShazer. Triumph and Blackberry performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wolfson composed and performed our theme music.
This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. Thanks for helping to keep our 30-year streak going at thiswayout.org.
Look for This Way Out Radio on social media and wherever you get your podcasts. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA.
For everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell.
And I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org.
And on 5GFM Kadena, South Australia.
99.1 Rehoboth Beach, Delaware.
KICI, Iowa City, Iowa.
And more than 200 other stations around the world.
Including this community radio station.
Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Vijay Prashad is good, very good, at connecting the dots. He doesn't look at political developments in isolation, nor does he examine social phenomena in only one part of the world. Prashad is an historian whose focus is global, and as a result, he can discern interconnections between, for example, technological development and globalization, between the so-called third world debt crisis and mass illiteracy, between corporate outsourcing and what he calls the investment strike. In a new working document put out by Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, Prashad lays out the origins, nature, and impact of neoliberal policymaking and corporate globalization. He also reveals how the power of people and of workers can be reasserted in a defiant, status quo-changing way. Vijay Prashad is the author of 25 books, including The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, and The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. Formerly a professor of history and international studies at Trinity College in Connecticut, he is now executive director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. When Vijay joined me recently in studio, I asked him about what he calls in his writing an international division of humanity.
You know, we've come a long way, perhaps in the last 70 years, but certainly in the last 30 years, where it's become absolutely acceptable to have 3 billion people around the planet be in hunger. It's become absolutely acceptable. You know, occasionally liberals will wring their hands and say, let's have an NGO or this or that. But, you know, it's okay to imagine a world where you walk past people who are starving. It's okay to bomb a city in Iraq or in Libya and not have to bear the consequences of that. You know, there's no tribunal to try the people who destroyed those cities. So what I mean is, that at least in the last 30 years, a gap has opened much wider than during colonial times between those whose humanity counts and those whose humanity no longer counts. I think that's what I mean by the international division of humanity.
You lay much of the blame for this inequality at the door of neoliberalism, and we've had many discussions about neoliberalism on this program. What is your thumbnail definition of it?
As far as I'm concerned, neoliberalism is a policy. Neoliberalism isn't a process. I'd like to spend a minute explaining what that means. You know, in about the 1970s, quite dramatic events took place, you know, what we would later call globalization. Now, it's true that international capitalism, or capitalism in general, strives for a global footprint, a global platform. No country must be outside its market. No country must be able to hide its resources. You know, capital, from its origin, in a sense, has had an appetite that spans the world. But this appetite was constrained by technology. It was constrained by politics. And by the 1970s, new technologies emerge that enable capitalism to have a global footprint. It's in the 1970s that we begin to see properly the computerization of databases. And because of satellite technology, because in a sense later of computerization and the internet, you're able to have a real-time, worldwide understanding of your inventory, of what is required in a shop that you have, say, in Berkeley, California, even though you're a company based in Singapore. You know, you know prices in real time all around the world. So in real time, information becomes global. This was not the case before the 1970s. So the first thing is this amazing way in which communication technology begins to span the world.
And so in other words, corporate globalization, are you saying, could not have occurred without the development of these new technologies?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, corporate globalization as an ambition predates these technologies. But these technologies allow that ambition to be realized. You know, let's just take the example of Nike. You know, Nike, you might know, makes no shoes. It outsources every single part of the production of its shoes. Nike essentially just makes a brand. It makes intellectual property. It would have not been able to do this without the development on the one side of communication, very important aspect, you know, that allows Nike to be in touch with its suppliers in Indonesia, in Vietnam, etc. But there's a second technological breakthrough that's equally important, and this has to do with transportation. You see, unless you can transport goods as quickly as possible, it becomes too expensive to move goods around. When a ship used to cross the Pacific Ocean and dock in Auckland Harbor, the ship would take, you know, I would say about a week to unload, because, you know, the people who would have to unload the ship would have to walk on board. They'd have to carry off these sort of jute sacks of goods, etc. Now a ship pulls into Oakland or pulls into the port of Los Angeles, and within hours, these enormous container ships are unloaded because the goods arrive on containers. The cranes grab the containers, put them on the backs of trucks directly, put them on the backs of trains, and they zip off to sorting and distribution sites. So from the 1970s, transportation became much more efficient. And therefore, because of this global span of communication and because transportation was so much more efficient, you were able to break up factories. You didn't have to have one giant factory, you know, Ford Motor Company, etc. You could have the chassis built in one place. You could have the wheels built somewhere else. You could have the car assembled in a third place. You know, this, what I call the disarticulation or breaking up of production, has extraordinary impacts on politics and on the ability of working class people to have power in the world. What this totality of what we call globalization does is it essentially allows people of means, you know, those who, you know, in another era were familiarly known as the capitalist class. The capitalist class no longer actually needs to invest a large amount of money in the production of goods and services. Now, the capitalist class in places like the United States, because they do a kind of what we consider an arm's length outsourcing, you know, they have firms in Indonesia or in Vietnam, as I said, or in Malaysia or in China. They have firms over there bear all the risk and do all the investment to produce, whether it's, you know, printed circuit boards for Apple or it's the soles of shoes for Nike. Those firms bear all the investment and risk.
These are the subcontractors, right? Many of whom are famous for not paying their employees very well, their workers very well.
These are exactly subcontracted firms. And, you know, they struggle to make a living because they are making a very small piece of the profit. This is not to defend them. It's to understand their place in the structure. A company like Nike or like Apple, which sits in the United States, doesn't have to take the risk of investing money for production because it's arm's length outsourced all that. It, in fact, just collects rent off its intellectual property. And so what this does for a country like the United States is it means that the tax base for governments is basically desiccated. It becomes very limited. These big companies, the very rich, go on a kind of tax strike. They refuse to pay taxation. They go on an investment strike. They're not investing within the country. They're not producing jobs. This hemorrhages the finances, the public finances of governments, municipal governments, state governments, the federal government. And to reply to that particular crisis of public finances, neoliberalism emerges as the solution. You know, neoliberalism as a policy isn't the cause of the problems in the world today. Neoliberalism is an attempt by the people who are in power to solve a problem which is really insolvable. And neoliberalism as a solution is extraordinarily limited because, you know, these governments don't have resources at their command unless they sell off things. So you see privatization of schools, privatization of water supply, you know, sale of public assets, including parks and gardens, you know, pay to play, where parents have to come to a park and they have to actually buy access to a park. This is a familiar thing for people in New York City, for instance. So public assets, scarce public resources, are sold off to the private sector to raise finances. You know, this is a solution. Neoliberalism is a solution which is basically unsustainable because how much can you keep selling?
Vijay Prashad is his name. He's an Indian historian, journalist, and author, and he's executive director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. What happened to intellectual property rights in the 1980s and 90s that played into the hands of capital?
I'm very glad you asked about intellectual property rights because it's an issue that has sadly been mistaken for piracy. When it's not really a question of piracy and theft. This is a very specific problem that needs to be thought of in terms of human freedom and in terms of basically human history. You know, what has been the way in which human beings have produced things, have been inventive and so on. So until the 1980s, until the round of the General Agreement of Trade and Tariffs, which was called the Uruguay Round, and this is, of course, what produced the world Trade Organization. During this round of negotiations in the 1980s, Western countries put on the table that the logic of intellectual property must be changed. It should be reversed. Previously, the actual product, let's, for an example, take a pharmaceutical drug. It's a very useful example because here is where we actually hit one of the most, I think, unscrupulous sections of the intellectual property debate. Let's take the cocktail for HIV/AIDS. And what previous intellectual property rights said is that nobody owns the right to the actual pill. You own the right only to the process. That is, Pfizer, a pharmaceutical company, owns the right to the way in which they made that pill. If somebody else is able to make that pill using a different process, then they are quite entitled to sell that in the market because you can only patent a process. You can't patent a product. Now, what this provided was ingenuity. That's why I said it's the history of human freedom and human ingenuity. Because scientists, engineers, you know, other people took the pill and they did what is known as reverse engineering. They said, this is in this pill. Well, how do we get there? And they came up with not only interesting ways to get there, but actually improvements on the drug itself. So what the Western countries said in this negotiation is now the product must be patented.
Not the process, but the product, the end product.
That's exactly correct. And if you, in whatever means, whatever process, made that product, you had to pay rent to the product's patent holder. So Pfizer was the one who patented that product. You'd have to pay rent to Pfizer. Now, the reason I said this thing about human history and so on is not to be, you know, odd and strange about this point, but simply to say that so many of our so-called inventions and discoveries are in the commons. You know, it's striking to me that a Western company, pharmaceutical company, owns the right to sell the drug for malaria. I mean, that drug, which is sold, you know, on the market, a very expensive drug for malaria, was developed by the people in the Andes when they first encountered, hundreds of years ago, the cinchona tree. And they realized that if they were able to manipulate the cinchona tree's bark, if they were able to take its essence and, you know, make a paste and eat it, they were protected to some extent from malaria. Well, the British take this discovery by the people of the Andes, bring the cinchona tree to Kew Gardens in England. They basically follow what the native people of the Americas did, and then you have a patent developed, and now the native people of the Americas have to buy that drug or pay a fine or be accused of piracy. This is why I say patent laws are against human history in a way. Now, what the patent law did for globalization, it meant that you could create factories all over the planet and you wouldn't worry that somebody was doing knockoffs of a Nike shoe. If they did a knockoff, you'd come after them for piracy. So what all this does is it impoverishes countries even further because their ability to create domestic industry is now basically cut back. Even if they developed these products, they'd have to pay rent to American or European firms.
Developing countries have gone through a lot of processes, a lot of crises over time, and you document some of these in this working paper put out by Tricontinental Institute for Social Research that you, Vijay, direct. One of them is the debt crisis, the third world debt crisis that reached a peak in the 1980s. What effect did that have? Well, tell us about the debt crisis and tell us what effect it had on globalization.
What happened was that right when the new states in Africa, Asia, and Latin America were attaining their independence, trying to create an independent economic policy, independent development, etc., they had to reach out to either commercial banks or to countries in the West to lend them money. I mean, there's no way you can, with almost no public resources, do any kind of development. They had to reach out to these countries. And most countries and most banks lent money, of course, you know, on commercial terms. They didn't lend it. They didn't give it to them. There was no Marshall Plan for, you know, decolonization, although there is a case to be made for it. You know, real reparations for countries that had been colonized. I often say that the British Industrial Revolution was paid by my ancestors. You know, they gave the down payment. So the issue of taking the loan was one thing. And in the loan documents, there was, of course, the fine print. And the fine print related the interest rate to what is known as the London Interbank Offer Rate.
The LIBOR.
LIBOR. Very arcane instrument that is how banks lend to each other. Now, basically, LIBOR has been generally quite stable and hasn't fluctuated much. So it was reasonable for these countries to borrow money at an interest rate which was indexed to LIBOR because LIBOR didn't shift much. It was quite reasonable. Well, this changes in 1979 when the United States, for the first time, quite dramatically raises its interest rates. You know, this is known as the Volcker shock, named after Paul Volcker. Now, what Paul Volcker and the American government did was they felt that the stagnation in the U.S. economy, it was called stagflation a combination of stagnation and inflation. This is during the Carter years. The belief was that if interest rates were, you know, raised quite dramatically inside the United States, then capital from around the world would flood into the United States. There'd be lots of money re-entering the country, and this would somehow go into investment and restart the economy. It was a kind of, let's say, what one does with a heart attack, a defibrillator. You know, you put the thing and you shock the system back to life. Of course, what this did was twofold. One is capital did indeed flee for the United States. But when U.S. interest rates went up, this triggered LIBOR. The London Interbank Offer Rate also went up. Now, that meant that countries which had quite reasonable interest rates, 2%, 3%, 4%, etc., suddenly saw their interest rates skyrocket. So whereas they were paying reasonable, you know, interest payments, some of them paying their principal down, now with the new arrangements after the Volcker shock, they found themselves in a position where they were not able to pay back the loans that they had taken. And the second thing was even worse. Because all that money fled to the United States, banks were not in a position, they were not, you know, filled with money where they were able to now lend these countries more money to help them pay back the loans and to do the kinds of things they had to do. So these countries went into spiral depression. They went into a debt crisis, which forced in many ways their governments to start cutting public services. And what you begin to see now in the 1980s is what is known as the IMF riot. In other words, the International Monetary Fund came into these countries and said to them, the only way to get out of your situation is essentially to cut back on all social spending, including subsidies on fuel, very important subsidy in most countries. It affects transportation. It affects the price of food. When they cut subsidies on fuel, there were riots in many parts of the third world. You know, there were bread riots in Cairo. There were riots about the rise of all foodstuffs in West Africa. And very famously in 1992, at the end of this period, in Caracas, Venezuela, there are major riots that break out. They're called the Caracazo, around the cut of subsidy for transportation. And by the way, it's this Caracazo that brings Hugo Chavez into politics. And, you know, that history moves on from there.
Vijay Prashad joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Vijay's books include The Death of the Nation and The Future of the Arab Revolution, No Free Left, The Futures of Indian Communism, and The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. We are talking about the first working document put out by his organization, Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. It's called In the Ruins of the Present. What did the third world debt crisis do to so-called third world nations' ability to bargain effectively with companies that wanted access to the resources and markets of these countries?
You know, it's interesting that in 1983, there was a non-aligned meeting in New Delhi. At the highest level, heads of governments came for this meeting. This was at the peak period of the debt crisis. And Fidel Castro of Cuba came to this meeting and he put out a proposal for discussion in which he said, we need to go on a strike. We should united, combined, refuse to pay at those interest rates. If the totality of the third world goes to the Paris Club, the London Club, this is the commercial lenders, the government lenders in the West, and we say to them, we are not going to pay you back at this rate. We'll, in other words, renegotiate our rate as a collective body. Then they may have to, you know, meet us somewhere. We don't have to basically accept their terms. Sadly, the political will was just not there in the rest of the third world. Castro was relatively marginalized. Now, what this meant was these countries individually started to bargain with the International Monetary Fund. And as part of the International Monetary Fund policy, they pushed an agenda called structural adjustment. Now, structural adjustment is in its language itself explains what's going on. What the IMF said to these countries, let's take Zambia as an example. Zambia, ruled by a political movement led by Kenneth Kaunda, very, very disciplined political movement. They developed education in the country during the period of independence. They produced a situation where, you know, hunger was not, you know, legion across the land, etc. I mean, they really had some improvements in Zambia, especially on the front of education and hunger. IMF shows up. They say to them, look, you're going to have to cut all these programs. You're spending too much on education. I mean, it's extraordinary. You have to structurally adjust your education spending. It's not a question of cutting it. You have to change the entire way in which you understand education. By the way, Zambia is one of the world's largest exporters of copper. And yet, I was told this, by the way, by the education ministry in Zambia, and yet today, in the copper belt of Zambia, 60% of children cannot read. You know, these are the children who grow up above one of the richest allotments of copper on the planet Earth. But before the IMF structural adjustment period, the copper belt had almost universal education. Today, 60% of the children cannot read. That is the detritus of the structural adjustment program. That program had real impact in these societies. And the impact it had was it increased hunger. There are 3 billion hungry people in the planet. It increased illiteracy and ignorance. And, you know, then people are surprised that these countries are in such difficult situations. This was entirely produced. I mean, that's the reason why the title of this document is In the Ruins of the Present. Because the present is a set of ruins. Ruins created by institutions like the International Monetary Fund, by the pressure put by the Group of Seven countries. You know, these are the advanced industrial states, mostly European, Canada, the United States and Japan. Immense pressure put by these institutions against these countries.
I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit more about this investment strike. And again, you're talking about capital because of its ability to use subcontractors in other nations. These are multinational firms using these subcontractors don't have to invest capital into their production processes like they would if they were rooted, say, in the U.S. as they were before. You discuss a kind of moral dimension to this withholding of money, this refusal to invest, this tax strike as well as the investment strike. Could you talk about that, like where this money could have gone, where it's not going, and the effect that has on the rest of us?
See, there's a problem of definitions, I think, immediately, which is when we think of capital, what do we mean by this? Do we mean the money that is held by people of power and wealth and is therefore their property? You know, if you understand capital as the property of powerful people, then it's very difficult to understand an alternative. If, on the other hand, you understand capital to be social wealth, I mean, this is, after all, the wealth produced by society, which is, you know, socially produced and privately appropriated. You know, that's how I understand capital. It's social production, private accumulation. You know, few people are taking the gains produced by everybody else. You see, if you have a so-called entrepreneur's understanding of capital, then you're going to say, well, the entrepreneur is the one who, you know, did everything, and therefore this is their money. They can do with it what they want. If you have the entrepreneur's attitude towards capital, you know, then private property is an inviolable issue in our society today. Politically, it's very hard to attack the idea of private property. It's the entrepreneur's money. They can do with it what they want. If they don't want to invest, it's up to them. If, on the other hand, you see it as social wealth, as wealth produced by society but held individually, then I think we as people in society have a claim on it. And we can say that we have produced goods from around the planet. You have hoarded this wealth. I mean, Thomas Piketty's book on income inequality called Capital comes as no surprise to the poor who sleep under bridges around the world. I mean, they know about inequality. Nonetheless, it's a very valuable study to have on the table to prove to people that inequality is real, that social production is privately accumulated, and look at the consequences. Fine. If you can make a claim on that money as social wealth, then there are so many things we would be able to do. You know, for instance, San Francisco is a city of great wealth. It's a city where there is immense private accumulation, and yet it's a hideous city. It's hideous because you cannot walk one block of the city without encountering people who are homeless, people who are suffering from exposure, people whose, you know, access to some of the basic decencies of humanity is left to their own devices. You also walk past buildings that are boarded up, which have been held by people who've privately accumulated wealth. If we saw wealth, even real estate, as a social fact, we would say, let's break the doors to this building. Let's have people go and live in there. Let's open more schools, community schools. People say, I want, you know, young people say, we want a place to go and perform our music. We want, artists say, we want a place to hang our paintings. Let's break open all the abandoned buildings, all the buildings that people of capital say we're waiting for the market to pick up before we do anything with. Well, we don't want to wait for the market to pick up. Society already needs it. So there is actually a direct confrontation on the moral plane between the idea of wealth being produced for me to hold on to until I can accumulate more wealth, and the other side, which says it is social wealth which must be used for society now to solve, you know, the pressing problems of society as we live in it.
Vijay Prashad, historian, author of 25 books, executive director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, which is an international movement-driven institution focused on stimulating intellectual debate that serves people's aspirations. We'll take a short break and speak more with Vijay. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Vijay Prashad's books include The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South, and Everybody Was Kung Fu Fighting, Afro-Asian Connections and the Myth of Cultural Purity. He writes regularly for The Hindu and Frontline in India and for Alternate. For 25 years, he was a professor at Trinity College in Connecticut, and now he directs Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. And we're talking about a working document, the first working document put out by Tricontinental and written by Vijay Prashad. So in this working document, you go into what's happened to trade union power over the years, and you write that, you know, because of this outsourcing and for other reasons, there's been a huge attack on workers' power and union power and unionization. We all know that unionization rates have gone down dramatically. And yeah, if you have people working for subcontractors in other countries, they often cannot unionize. They have no collective power. There's no collective bargaining. You write that we need to revive trade union power. Can you talk about how important that is to turn things around and to confront neoliberalism and corporate globalization? And what do you mean? Like, what would be a way that we can revive unionized power, the power of workers as a collective?
Well, this is a very important issue because it's basically to the question of the survival of the human species, honestly. I don't exaggerate when I say this. The question that needs to be asked is, what is a worker? Who is a worker? Is a worker somebody who has a full-time job with benefits and has the ability to join a union? Or is a worker anybody who is forced to go out there and sell their time, sell their abilities to somebody, and therefore is producing something for somebody else? Whether they are able to actually get that job or not, they are workers, in my opinion. In other words, those who are so-called unemployed, those who are working precarious jobs, those who've given up working, all of those people, all of us are workers, because we're essentially all in a position where we're selling our abilities and our time to somebody else for their gain and for our survival and sustenance. The difference between those who can get the jobs and those who cannot get the jobs, to my mind, is about the jobs, not about them being workers. They are both workers. Now, why I say this is that as there's been an attack on unions, on kind of permanent jobs and so on, many unions around the world have become extraordinarily defensive. And they've tried to protect their members or to protect some of the gains that their members have been able to win. They have forgotten, in a sense, many of them, that their unions are a political organization, not merely a club for their members. And this example was, I think, quite fittingly shown in India in September of 2016. The organized trade union movement in India is in the tens of millions. You know, there may be about 15 to 20 million Indian workers in the organized sector, very small. You know, 90% of Indian workers are in the informal sector. You know, so the percent that are in unions are very small. In the summer of 2016, the formal trade unions declared that they would have a one-day general strike across India. But the issues that they released were very interesting. They didn't release issues that had to do with bank employees or had to do with rail employees. These are the organized sector where there are quite considerably strong unions. They weren't talking about their issues. The entire slate of demands that they made were for informal sector workers. In other words, the formal sector came out and said, we're going on strike. We're going to have the biggest possible strike, and we're going to have this on the demands of the informal sector. And would you believe it, in September of 2016, 180 million Indian workers went on strike.
It's kind of unbelievable. I mean, that's half the population of the U.S.
It is indeed half the population of the U.S., and to my mind, it's the largest strike in human history. It was a real general strike. Of course, uneven, different parts of India, more people struck. You know, India is itself a continent. 180 million workers. But the lesson here isn't the number. It's that the formal sector workers in India have begun to understand that the only way to defend worker rights is to defend the rights of every worker, not to allow the limited labor laws that try to restrict trade unionism to your workplace and even want to destroy that. But they have to understand this not as their workplace issue, but as a class issue, as an issue of the totality of the working people in their country. That's the first important lesson. The second important lesson, and you're quite right to raise the issue of how difficult it is to organize in subcontracted firms. You know, if people travel, let's say, to Mexico or to, let's say, Malaysia, to some of these export processing free trade zones, the factory looks like a prison. You know, there are huge walls around the factory. Workers go through a so-called security check at the gate. Anybody who talks about a union is going to be fired immediately. It's almost impossible to organize a union inside those factories. I mean, inside in India, outside Delhi, in Manesar, the workers of the Maruti factory, it's a Maruti Suzuki factory, have struggled bravely to build a union inside that factory. But it has come at huge cost, you know, terrible attacks on the workers, physical violence. They were locked into the factory. I mean, it's not easy. But it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It's just it's not easy. So the second major lesson is that, look, the point is to organize the working class, not to organize a trade union. So that in places like South Africa, India, in Brazil, places where our institute has offices, we are looking very closely at experiments being conducted there, where working class organizations are not organizing people at the point of production in the factory. They're organizing them where they live. They're organizing them in their neighborhoods. And I'll give you one quick example for this. In Bolivia, in the town of Cochabamba, it became quite famous for the so-called wars against the privatization of water. But the story of that war against water privatization is very important. Water privatization was going to impact the working class of Bolivia, the working people of Bolivia, again, whether they had jobs or not. initially, when privatization to Bechtel Corporation, a San Francisco-based corporation, when it was announced initially, there was some small protests against it. People were upset. And then the Confederation of Trade Unions, led by Oscar Olivares, a very important figure in this struggle, the Trade Union Federation decided to put their entire weight to combat water privatization. They understood that in the place of life, they were going to be throttled. So they had to defend where workers live. And it was the workers and the unions that built that anti-privatization campaign, and they won. Now, what's interesting is, when people talk about the struggle in Bolivia, they talk about it as if these were sort of NGOs or, you know, new social movements, etc. They don't emphasize the fact that these were trade unionists who brought all the skills of trade union organizing. It requires an immense amount of discipline and skill to build a movement. This is not simply about Bolivia. We're seeing this across the global south, you know, whether it's shack dwellers organizing in South Africa, very important development run by a group in Durban called Abashali, you know, fighting to have the right to build a home for people who are workers, you know, who come in on small buses. I mean, I saw this last month. Workers leave the shacks, come in small buses, and, you know, they come into the city and they have the very jobs that keep the city going. In other words, they produce social wealth, but they don't have anywhere to live. So they've built these shacks, so-called illegal dwellings. And the shack dwellers movement, the Abashali movement, defends their right to be there in those shacks as a place to live. You know, it comes back to this idea of private accumulation of public or of social production. These are people who are producing things socially, but they're unable to even live, to have a place to live. So unions need to build power, not only for their own workplace, but for the entirety of working people, to take up the issues of all working people. That's the only way unions are going to grow beyond their very narrow confines. You see, the worst way for a union to grow is to attach itself to a political party and provide funds for that party. You know, in the United States, the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, made a choice, you know, in the Clinton years. They could have pivoted from workplace organizing to neighborhood organizing. Instead, they pivoted from workplace organizing to financing the Democratic Party. And that didn't get the American workers much. It was a really bad deal. I think people in the United States need to learn some lessons from what's been happening in places like India, South Africa, Bolivia, and so on. The lesson being, you've got to defend the totality of working people, not just your union. And secondly, you have to organize where people live. That's why issues like the movement for Black Lives, it's not a movement of African Americans or Latinos or whatever. That's a working class movement. It's working class people, working class people of color who feel the brunt of, you know, state surveillance and state violence. And as a class, unions need to take up these issues.
Would you agree, though, that if there were, and I'm sure there are in certain countries, a militant workers' rights political party out there, that collaborating with unions, with working class movements in a country could be a very powerful force, could create a kind of synergy that could really change the status quo?
Well, I mean, that's hard to argue with that, because I think it's very much true that in, say, in India, there are left political parties that provide, in a sense, the kind of theory, the cadre, the people who are actually going to go out and do the work of building movements. I mean, recently, an enormous, huge population, 100,000 Indian farmers, marched 190 kilometers from Nasik to Mumbai, the major financial capital of India, the capital of the state of Maharashtra. They marched 190 kilometers, arrived in Mumbai, and forced the government, essentially, to accept demands which the government had dithered on previously. Well, the only way they were able to do that is they were organized by the All India Kisan Sabha, that's the Farmers Union, which is basically the front organization of the Communist Party. So this issue of having a left party there is very important, because left parties provide a kind of discipline. They enable young people to understand what it means to be a worker in a mass organization. I mean, you know, if we were to back up and come to the question of the U.S. for a second, in the United States, because the left parties don't have a tradition of mass organizations, they become increasingly sectarian. You know, in other words, you don't have a buffer. You don't have a way for somebody to enter into a mass struggle. Here, the mass or whatever appears as a mass organization has to follow the party line. You know, this is our political line. You now in an anti-racist group, you have to adopt the line. In mass organizations in India, in South Africa and other places, they don't have to follow the line. They develop their own line independently. I mean, the key parts of political struggle isn't having the correct position. It's to develop the consciousness of people and to develop their confidence that they are able to come in and struggle and that they have some view that they need to struggle. So this is the kind of theoretical apparatus that political organizations provide. So you're quite right to raise the issue of the absence of a political organization, I think, makes a mass organization be a little more disoriented than it needs to be.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Vijay Prashad is my guest. And Vijay, you, as I mentioned before, for more than two decades, you were a professor at Trinity College. You were also the Edward Said Chair at the American University of Beirut for a time. And now you have formed and you direct Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. What has that organization, that institution, been formed to do?
A few years ago, political organizations in Brazil, in South Africa, and different parts of the world began to talk to each other. And they essentially said that there were two or more limitations. Let's just talk about two of them. Two limitations that they found. One is, in the so-called battle of ideas, their opinions were not being taken seriously. Nobody really was representing what, let's say, a group like Abashali from Durban, South Africa, was articulating about their politics. You know, what do shack dwellers believe? This was not something that was being taken very seriously. In the battle of ideas, their interpretation of reality was not being able to command even a hearing. The point I made about private appropriation of social wealth. Well, you know, this is a movement point. This is a point that these movements have made for decades, arguing that, look, you know, we're the ones coming into the city and working. We're not taking things from you, taking welfare check. Are you kidding? Taking a welfare check? We earn the money for that. It's just that our wages are so low that we can't survive. These are their opinions that need to be amplified, and the battle of ideas needs to be joined. That was one issue. The second issue, and I think this is a very important issue, they said that intellectuals globally, intellectuals were detaching themselves from movements. Increasingly, intellectual production was becoming about intellectual production. In other words, young scholars were entering the academy. They were trying to find gaps in the scholarly literature to fill. And that's how they developed their project. They were not necessarily looking at gaps in the world, you know, political gaps or issues that political movements said need solutions. This was not being taken up and studied. PhDs were not being written based on the dilemmas facing humanity, as it were. So these two issues were very important for them. And over the course of the past few years, this discussion has gone further. And I came into this discussion in the middle of it, and we decided that we'll create an institution, an Institute for Social Research. We have offices in New Delhi, in Johannesburg, South Africa, in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and in São Paulo, Brazil. The offices are staffed by people, intellectuals from these movements, and we understand intellectual in a very broad way. They include militants, they include journalists, etc., not merely academics, although some of them are academics. They staff the offices. We have a kind of central network, and we are going to produce a series of things for people to take cognizance of. For instance, regular newsletters, dossiers, working documents like this. We want to hold meetings. We're going to hold a meeting in Brazil where Brazilian and Chinese intellectuals are going to gather together to talk about the question of China in Brazil. There'll be no intellectuals from Europe, United States, etc. We want the Brazilians and Chinese to engage with each other, to develop an understanding together, to develop their capacity to discuss this issue without it being brought into somebody else's anxiety or their own problems, whatever. So these two issues, the battle of ideas and building the bridge between intellectuals and the movements, this is our fundamental work that we're going to do in Tricontinental. The Battle of Ideas question is something that I know very well, because this is part of, honestly, part of being a journalist as much as being a college professor. You know, journalists are in the battle of ideas, you know, in the battle to interpret reality. You know, was the shooting in the Gaza perimeter a deadly clash, as the Associated Press said, or was it murder? I mean, that's the battle of ideas. We're trying to analyze and interpret a reality which everybody can see on a YouTube video. You know, that's easy. The harder thing is to convince intellectuals, because, you know, careerism sets in and so on, but to influence intellectuals to make the dilemmas of humanity be the drivers of their research agenda and not gaps in the literature. You know, not gaps in the literature that are going to get them good scores in the journals and therefore get them to be promoted and so on. You know, I understand what has happened to intellectual life intimately. How, you know, some of those so-called the pressures of corporate academy have, you know, come in. I mean, I understand all that. And nonetheless, you know, if you're in this for a career, go work for a bank. You know, there are other ways to make much more money. You know, intelligent people, why are you wasting your time here? If you're going to be an intellectual, I think the dilemmas of humanity should be somewhere in your consciousness, not on the side. And in the center of that should be the political movements that are trying to tackle those dilemmas. Take some advice from the movements. Don't use them to do your research. I think that's the kind of lesson I've taken from my meetings with these political movements. They want intellectuals to come and work with them, alongside them, and sometimes for them, but not to use them. I think that has been the default option.
What do you plan for the second working document put out by Tricontinental?
So, you know, our working documents, this one was, as it were, authored by me, but it's really a very collective process in the sense that, you know, I've been having meetings with movements and talking to people and spent a great deal of trying to understand how they see the current conjuncture, the current moment. And I've basically summarized these conversations into the document. The second document is going through the same process. And it's about something that should be of interest to people. It's about, well, we're not sure exactly what we're going to call it, but for now I'll just call it digital colonialism. You know, the issue of, for instance, data harvesting, how big data companies, let's say even Google, will show up in Ghana and they'll tell the government, you know, why don't we collect your, you know, information, the census information and so on. We'll do it for free. And these countries say, fine. And of course, these big data companies are mining information. It's just like mining copper. You know, for free, they are getting all this human information. And we're giving it to them for free. So we are looking into the issue of digital colonialism like this. We're looking into the issue of, for instance, how productive and unproductive labor works. You know, what does it mean to move to so-called digital capitalism? What impact is this going to have for work, for labor, and so on? So again, it's a kind of broad document which we hope will stimulate some discussion. You know, there are movement schools across the world that are already looking at our work. We have produced things in English and Spanish, but, you know, these documents are already being translated into Turkish. They'll be in Hindi. They'll be in other languages, in French, and they're going to be used in movement schools where militants are trained, where radicals go to, you know, have their study camp and so on. So we are basically trying to build curriculum for militants more than anything else, so that our militants around the world have an alternative way to get information, have an alternative way to begin an argument. You know, why should we begin our debates and arguments from terms set by somebody else, you know, by Thomas Friedman? You know, why should Thomas Friedman, his article in a newspaper, be brought into a union hall and that becomes the terms of the debate? We would like to set the terms of the debate. And I think that's what the second document will do as well. It'll engage issues of, you know, the internet, of internet capitalism and so on.
The website of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research is thetricontinental.org. The tricontinental.org. Vijay Prashad, historian, journalist, author of books like The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, chief editor of Leftward Books based in New Delhi, and executive director of Tricontinental. Thanks so much, Vijay, for joining me in studio.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And that interview first aired on April 10th of this year. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.